why you're invested with us, that's able to fund the Institute for us as well, so we can continue that research. And then lastly, I would just say that asset-wise, that we're now, the dividend payment is now over $2 billion that's gone to the Stowers Institute. So, and then we'll skip this slide because that's just bringing you up to date, but this is just a snapshot of the various capabilities that we offer and the asset classes. So we have to have diversification in order to bring in business so we can fund that Stowers Institute. We've had recent launches within the fixed income space, ETFs, and then expansion of the Avantis investors. And then our net flows are positive year to date. So we're a healthy firm that's now at $3.4 billion positive net flows into American Century. And so that's just a brief intro of American Century and what we do. And if there's no other questions on the firm, then we can really dive deep into your portfolio and hand it over to Jim and Trevor to go through the brief macro update.
Great. As you know, this is your time, so feel free to interrupt, take us in a direction where we can make the best use of your time. I'm going to keep my comments very brief. I really want to hand it over to Trevor to talk about what he's seeing in the equity market, specifically the non-U.S. small cap markets, what is occurring with your portfolio as well, but just at a high level in terms of our macroeconomic outlook. First of all, we don't have a firm economist. We do have a fixed income team and an asset allocation team. In terms of what they're seeing in the markets, what they're seeing from an inflation perspective, a monetary policy perspective, there is the expectation that we will see two additional rate cuts in the U.S. In Europe, we've already seen 8 rate cuts since mid-2024. We're probably closer to the end of that rate cut cycle. But we do think that is a relatively benign backdrop, particularly for equities. In terms of fixed income views going forward, their bias is still more towards higher quality, high grade investment income, fixed income instruments. In terms of the outlook for the economy, there's a lot of tailwinds and headwinds. The markets are constantly changing, new tariffs, new sanctions. So this can change by the minute. But in general, if we look at what the fixed income team and asset allocation team is thinking of going forward, what is the most likely scenario? This is looking out at their view over the next 6 months, giving a probability of what to expect. Once again, this is subject to change, but the most likely scenario is a moderation of growth. They are not forecasting a recession. But they do see some signs of moderating growth, some signs of weakness in the economy. But that is then offset by, once again, a more favorable interest rate backdrop. We think that is particularly attractive for equities and small cap equities. There are some other potential positives. And if you look at how this compares to 6 months ago, they have become a bit more positive on the potential for a growth surprise. So right now that's at around 15% probability. That was 10% last year. I mean, some of the potential tailwinds that could lead to a growth surprise, lower taxes here in the U.S., the impact of the big, beautiful bill. We have a bit more certainty around tariffs going forward. So there are indications that we could see potentially better economic growth than what was expected 6 months ago. That is the U.S. perspective, and Trevor will go into more detail about what he's seeing outside of the U.S., but we are also seeing some pretty significant stimulus spending, particularly within Europe, Germany in particular. That is also positive for growth going forward, in addition to stimulus measures within China. So we think this is a pretty attracted back. Yes.
So, correct me if I'm, well, I should ask a question rather than make a statement. To what extent are the surprises, inconsistencies, states of flux a factor as opposed to the underlying issues like tariffs, complaint for lack of information, you know, no reporting now on job growth or inflation from the government, et cetera. To what extent is the flux itself a factor? And if it is a significant factor, is the market simply writing it off over time and assuming that this won't continue, it seems to? Or is that just the political noise on the front page of the Times?
You know, it's probably a mix of both. I think where we get the best insights oftentimes is not necessarily from what the government is reporting, but what we're hearing from company management teams on a global basis. So Trevor and his team meet with roughly 2,000 companies per year. And oftentimes that is where we see the greatest insight. And I think one factor that has changed over the last 6 months, there still is not perfect clarity to any extent, but some of the fears and concerns that management teams were facing around tariffs have lessened. It hasn't gone away, but it has gotten marginally better. Some of the stimulus, particularly outside of the U.S., is having an impact in terms of leading to a more positive outlook, particularly for non-U.S. and European economies. But there's still a lot of noise out there. Our focus is more on the companies, what their prospects are, because you can get so caught up in the noise. And we're not making decisions based on a 5% better probability of a growth surprise. Trevor and team are making decisions based on where they're seeing growth from a bottom-up perspective.
Okay. And I guess the follow-up then is to what extent are the tariffs themselves actually having an impact on these 2,000 businesses? Is it real or is it being absorbed without any significant impact?
So a couple of things. First of all, quick introduction. My name is Trevor Gorich. I've been working with American Century now since 1998 when we launched this strategy in 2001. So people get around to have two centuries of experience in this field. What we've seen, and the thing I say is the only consistency in life is inconsistency. We're always dealing with uncertainty. We're always dealing with things that are changing. We're always dealing with uncertainty. And how do you get around that? Tariffs, to answer your question specifically, have mixed effects. I would actually argue for small cap companies, which we invest in, there is a lesser impact of tariffs. You're not dealing with GM or a Chrysler or a BMW that has multiple manufacturing facilities in multiple countries. You're dealing with oftentimes local for local businesses. For example, Auto One is a company that we're invested in Germany. This is a online car retailer. They sell cars in Germany online. Maybe it's a CarMax or a Car Gurus or a Carvana. But there's a 1% market share that they've achieved. Whether you have tariffs or no tariffs, their business will probably grow to maybe a 5 or 10% penetration. And that is a specific growth driver for that business. In fact, you could argue if there are tariffs that limit the sales of German cars to the U.S., they'll have more inventory. So they might actually be a net beneficiary. There are some businesses out there, you know, a U.S. business, for example, Elf Beauty, a retail cosmetics. 80 to 90% of their products are produced in China. They had a little bit of an issue. What they did is two things. One, they started diversifying some of their production base out of China. Two, they raised prices. So the average price of one of the units was $5. They raised to $6. You know, that's a 20% price increase that way overcomes the tariff. The other thing with tariffs is not the full price of the object is tariffed. Obviously, the component that is produced in that region would be tariffed and might only be 20 or 30% of the full price of the product. Second of all, the tariff is often shared between the manufacturer, the importer, and the final client. So you do see that tariff impact distributed amongst that food chain. The third thing you're seeing, and this is my belief, is that the tariffs are set up to a large degree by Washington to negotiate better deals for other things. So a lot of these tariffs might be tools to accomplish other goals. A great tool I see was the fact that the U.S. pulled away from supporting Europe in terms of military expense. And the first time in 75 years, Germany has actually decided to break their budgets and spend €1 trillion over the next 10 years to reinforce their infrastructure and reinforce their defense. That was money that the U.S. was going to be spending, and that saves the U.S. money, but actually makes Germany take out debt and spend it. So it's a very good question. It's a very complex question. It's very name specific.
I think it was a simple question. The answer is complex.
But you know, it does create a lot of really interesting opportunities, and especially in the global small cap universe.
Thank you.
With the prospect of a slowdown or some moderation of the market, and the prospect of lowering interest rates, do you expect that the risk of stagflation may continue to rise, even if we don't necessarily hit it?
So that's also a very difficult question. The reason is how much inflation is tariffs going to bring. We haven't seen that much yet. Second of all, when you drop rates, you're actually seeing a stimulus, a net stimulus to the markets. And I think part of the goals of this administration is to give a jolt to the economy, especially the manufacturing sector, by bringing jobs back, by bringing manufacturing infrastructure back, by reshoring, but also the housing sector. And the housing sector is really driven by mortgage rates, and bringing rates down restarts another cycle. So we personally don't think that there's going to be stagflation. It might be mild inflation, but we do see growth. And we do see actually growth accelerating, or inclinations of growth accelerating. For us in the global small cap, or in non-US small cap, international small cap, we see this as a highly favorable environment. And the reason that is maybe turning onto the slide here, we've had a very tough five-year period when post-COVID, we ratcheted up rates 500 basis points, so 5 percentage points. That created a very strong headwind for small caps versus large caps. On the chart here, you see that grayish blue line. That's the interest rate increase. And just go up a little bit, Jim, so you can see the time scale. Thanks. Post-COVID, you start to see those rates increase, that grayish blue line. In 2000, going all the way up to 4 or 5%. And that created a very strong headwind for small caps versus large caps. So at the same time, you see that grayish blue line going up, you see the relative performance of small versus large in dark green going down. So that has created a very difficult situation for small caps and also for growthier small caps. The primary reason for that is 30 to 40% of the balance sheets of small caps are variable debt. So as rates go up, you're immediately having to pay more interest to the bank. As rates start to come down, and as Jim mentioned, we do believe that there's going to be further rate cuts. There's been one already, 25 basis point cut. There's going to be another one at the end of this month, another 25 basis points. And there's over 90% certainty that there's going to be a third one in December, which is going to bring down rates 75 basis points this year. That immediately goes down to the bottom line of many of these small cap companies. Not only that, but the second thing that happens is consumer sentiment starts to pick up. People start looking to buy houses again, they start to buy cars again, that affordability cycle gets to be a lot better. And third of all, when you're valuing small cap companies, you take a look at the net present value of the future cash flows and your weighted average cost of capital comes down, which actually helps to re-rate these businesses because you're valuing them using a lower cost of capital. So those three forces really help the small cap universe quite significantly, which is why you're starting to now see small caps outperform large caps. We go to the next slide. This slide is essentially showing you the headwinds that small cap growth has had relative to small cap value. Again, you see that rate increase in that turquoise blue, and then small cap growth versus small cap value. You had a very big sell-off, and this fortunately provided quite a big headwind for our strategy because we're much more growth oriented. We invest in the businesses that we think over the next 5 to 10 years are going to be the leaders. We're not necessarily investing in utilities. We're not necessarily investing in businesses that don't grow, that have just a pure value. So, you know, what we've seen is that those higher interest rates hurt that growth versus value, but in the last year, that's been a neutral factor, which is also part of the reason why our relative performance has picked up so strongly over the last year, creating over 500 basis points of alpha generation.
So I think you're getting to this, but, you know, comparing the large cap and small cap performance to each other, you know, 2021, with the commodity craziness that was happening, that was probably what hit large cap pretty bad. And seemed like a lot of people were linked to small cap. And maybe that helps, especially with your strategy. Do you see that was kind of a unique situation, or do you see those dynamics playing out again, even if it's not a commodity driven thing? It's not a.
Yes. Are you sorry? Are you talking about 22 or 21? Because 22 is when you had the Ukraine war. That's when commodities really shot up, right? 21, and that was bad. If you go back to
our fiscal quarter 20.
Okay, yeah. So 20 was when small caps did very well. That was when a lot of stimulus was in the marketplace. That's when COVID stimulus came into place. That's when a lot of the funding was put into the market where that really helped to drive a lot of those small cap prices and valuations. And you can see that on page 11. You see that run up in 2021 of the small caps. But in 22, that's when you had a couple of big issues started coming through. You started seeing the inflation prints picking up. And you also saw the invasion of the Ukraine by Russia, which really drove up quite significantly the energy price. It also rose and increased some of the precious metal price.
My description was incorrect because after the quantity thing, small cap started hurt.
Right. So when we just take a look at some of the factors that have driven over time the relative performance in, this is the small cap universe. So what you see here is that grayish line on top is value stocks in the small cap universe. And that sharp rise in yields has created a significant headwind for growth stocks. So you see there's almost a 40%, greater than 40% difference in performance of growth stock, of value stocks versus growth stocks. And that's part of the reason why, you know, we've been managing money since 2001. We do see these factors. We haven't seen a 5-year term period as long as this, but usually these things revert. Because again, what is the market going to pay for? We believe ultimately the market pays for earnings. And that's what drives stock prices, which is the core of our philosophy.
So I think maybe it's worth pointing out, we're talking about non-US right now. That's what the focus is. Story looks different inside the US. So a lot of the times when we're talking focusing, we're talking US small cap. So what's been happening outside the US looks vastly different.
If you can tell that in a minute or two.
I guess the very simplest thing is the AI-driven names in the U.S. have really proliferated down. And so that's been driving most of the market in the U.S. So growth has dramatically outperformed value on both large and small cap outside the U.S. Not quite as much until the comments were made, yield advantages and whatnot have helped value more outside the U.S. It does bring up a question that I have, because certainly here, you know, if you're looking at the Russell 2000, we've seen a proliferation of non-earners in the index. I think something like 60% of the names in the Russell 2000 right now have negative zero or negative earnings. Mm-hmm. Are you seeing similar things outside the U.S.? How does that relate? Because that has presented challenges as well for a lot of active managers, as you're looking at names that are not necessarily otherwise attractive because of challenges there. So are we seeing similar things? Because I know that that's a lot of the story.
Well, what's great is that we manage not only non-U.S., but we also manage global. So we do have exposure to the U.S. and those U.S. companies, and we know the story very well. The U.S. small cap market has a huge amount of non-earners, a huge amount of non-revenue companies. You have some revenue, non-revenue companies like these small modular reactor companies that basically have a business plan to develop some type of nuclear power technology that are $15, $20 billion companies without, you know, a dollar of revenue. That's typically not what we're going to invest in, because we need to see the revenues and we need to see the profits, because that's ultimately what our core beliefs are. In the non-U.S. markets, you have far fewer of those. So what we are seeing are, you know, where are we seeing the value really driving performance in the non-U.S. markets are, for example, Japanese banks. Japanese banks, since 1980, have not grown. But for the first time, you're seeing inflation in Japan. And that's actually very positive for banks, because you start to expect interest rate increases. When you have interest rate increases, the core earnings driver of a bank is the net interest margin, what they lend at versus, you know, what you're paying, and what their cost of capital is. And so as a result, what we're seeing is a very strong outperformance of especially, you know, Japanese businesses that for the first time have actually started to grow in this inflationary environment. Because remember, Japan's been in deflation for 40 years. And that's been a very powerful fact. In fact, value in Japan has grown 1,000 basis points. Returns for the value in Japan are about 100% versus growth, which is about 10-12%. So there's been a huge, there's almost been a 90% disparity between growth and value in Japan. And that's also a lot of those unwinding of those very bulky companies in Japan that are, you know, diversifying and now starting to divest some of their non-core holdings and streamlining the operations. So you're seeing a whole new shareholder frenzy happening in Japan, which is driving a lot of stock prices, which is also one of the reasons why you saw Warren Buffett going in and investing in some of the Japanese trading companies. So you know, that is something that's really resonating out of the U.S. Also, what?
I guess one question I have is, it seems like you're focused on the growth of revenue. Whenever you see the disparity between value and growth, you view that as momentum for growth, for that situation kind of reconciled. But how much of that is sometimes locked by policy or locked by other factors where that momentum may not be there? And then, yeah, I'll
So small cap companies oftentimes are really driven by the CEO, by the business opportunity. It's not necessarily a big policy, just top-down driving decision. Unless you're dealing with something like a gold mine, which is driven by high gold prices, or a copper mine, or a bank, which is driven by interest rates. But, you know, when we look at our portfolio, you know, we have really amazing companies. One that comes to mind, you know, there are so many individual companies, but when you take a look at Aritzia, I'm sure you guys have Aritzia in Arizona, but this is a woman's retailer. They essentially make puffy coats, puffy jackets that caters to women between 16 and 35. This is a business that has the right product at the right time, and they are expanding their store chain very, very quickly all the way across America. They're originally Canadian, but they continue to deliver earning surprises, revenue surprises, because they have the right product at the right time. Another company out of Japan, which you probably all know, is Sanrio. Sanrio is Hello Kitty. Hello Kitty has done an exceptionally good job, because what's happened is the leadership of the company has changed from the grandfather to the grandson, who's taken the business and modernized it. So now they're using social media to promote all the different characters. They're really getting a huge acceleration in followers and are able to sell their Hello Kitty merchandise globally much faster. So policy decisions are not really going to be relevant to Hello Kitty. Similarly, in Japan, ASICS, the running shoe company, competes with Nike and Adidas and On Holdings. ASICS has done an extremely good job of, again, restructuring their business to focus on higher margin products, to focus on running, to focus on niche sports. Djokovic, tennis player, is sponsored by ASICS. That's really driven their tennis business. Their running shoe business has really taken margins. When we invested in the company, margins were low single digit. Now they're mid double digits, and we think they're still going higher. All this is not driven by policy. It's driven by management driving strategic change.
The follow-up question would be, would you say that what differentiates you from, say, investing more in large cap, is that you're looking at true business strategies on the ground and how they'll form, whereas large cap is often speculative, often not based in a foundational or something to that effect. I'm sure you're doing better, but like, how would you sell your strategy versus, say, investing in large?
Very, very clearly, there are three things that differentiate us. One, we believe earnings drive stock prices. Two, we believe that the small cap market is highly inefficient at identifying inflection points or changes in companies' fundamentals. And three, if you invest in companies as they start to inflect, you take advantage of both that stair-stepping earnings growth, plus what usually happens is the market starts to re-rate that better earnings growth and earnings outlook. So that's what differentiates us, and that's exclusively what my team of 11 are doing on a day-in, day-out basis. That's why we're meeting 2,000-plus companies every year. Because we're trying to understand from the CEOs what their strategy is, what their products are doing, why they're going to succeed. Every company that we look at, we go through a four-step process. We say, is there an inflection? Is that inflection sustainable? And when I say sustainable, I say on a 12 to 18-month basis. That's a period of time that we can actually look and we can understand and we can put metrics together to say, is this business going to beat those expectations? And we use that to form a gap, which is the third part, the G. The gap says, okay, we think this company that's forecasted by consensus analysts to earn a dollar is actually going to earn $1.25. So it's going to be 25% higher. When we're at that point, we then go to the V, which is the valuation, which says, given that this company is going to grow 25 to 30%, it's going to earn $1.25. What type of valuation do we ascribe to that? And is that attractive on a risk return basis? And that's how we look at each and every company, and that's what differentiates us. Your question on small caps versus large caps, I mean, every investor has a different style. There are some deep value, there's some growth, there's some macro. So, you know, there are a lot of ways that work. Again, I've been doing this now for 27 years. Our 25-year track record on the strategy has delivered alpha over 25 years of 200 basis points plus per year on average. We've had a very tough five-year period because of these headwinds that I've talked about. But again, we do think that that's going to revert. Now, if we take a look at page 15, Jim, maybe that's a good slide to look at here.
I think maybe real quick, I'll clarify, this strategy is just specific to small cap, not U.S. small cap. So the other managers you have on the non-U.S. side are a little bit more focused on capitalization. This strategy is just supposed to be investing in non-U.S. small cap.
And then before you go to that slide, how much of what's the percentage of our total assets roughly that are invested with this particular strategy? How much money do we have out there?
It's just under 5%.
Just under 5. Okay. So roughly $40 to $50 million.
Yeah. So as of the end of September, it was basically $52 million.
Okay. Keep going.
Yeah. Right. So this chart is essentially showing the returns of small caps versus large caps over time.
In the non-U.S.
and in non-U.S. small caps. What you see here is that over time, non-U.S. small caps typically outperform the large cap companies. But there are periods of time where you get underperformance. We saw that during the GFC, during 2008, 2009, 10. We saw that during COVID. But now what we've seen is a five-year period of underperformance because of that rapid rate. Where I'm excited and why I think this is changing is because I do believe the direction of interest rates is lower. I do believe that small caps offer very good local for local business opportunities that can circumvent a lot of the tariff issues and the big macro points. And what we're starting to see, as you can see, as you break out of that yellow box there, you're starting to see the outperformance again of the small versus large. And it makes sense, I believe, for smaller companies to do better over time, just because they grow much faster. And they are also far more dynamic. So what happens is you're taking maybe a little bit more risk, but the return comes back to you over time. When we take a look at the outlook, and this is another thing that I think is very attractive today with small caps versus large caps. So this chart here on the screen is showing the consensus outlook for small caps versus large caps. The top is 2025, the bottom is 2026. I'm going to highlight the gold box on the right, where you see for 2025, small cap growth is looking at 13% growth versus large caps at 12%. And next year, forecasted earnings per share growth is 22% versus 16% for large caps. And what's also interesting to note on the slide is that if you take a look at every region here, you're seeing each region starting to accelerate, and you're seeing pretty broad-based growth across all global regions. And everywhere except for Japan, small-cap growth is outpacing large-cap growth. So, you know, three reasons we like small caps. One, we believe there's very strong visible growth going forward. Two, valuations are attractive, and maybe go forward one page, Jim. Here you see valuation of large versus small. So this is the PE ratio of large versus small. And you see that historically we've traded at a premium to the large cap. The average is about 50 basis point premium. We're now trading at about a 50 basis point discount. So it's about a one standard deviation discount. Versus the large cap. So valuations are, we think, very attractive. Also, when you take a look at the absolute level of valuation here, what you're seeing is that on the bottom left, the aggregate small cap universe, you're paying 15 times earnings for what we saw as 22% growth. That equates to a price earnings growth ratio of about 0.7 times, which both from an absolute and a relative basis is very attractive, especially when you're comparing that to large caps, which are probably north of 20 times earnings for, you know, 10% growth. So you're paying almost 0.7 versus a 2 times PEG ratio, price earnings growth ratio. So for us, that's, you know, another reason why we think that small caps are poised to do well. Great growth, great valuation. And the third, as we've spoken here, is we think that economic outlook is actually going to be pretty good and pretty favorable for this asset class, especially as those interest rates start to decline.
So I've heard similar arguments about emerging market equity for 30 years now.
Mm-hmm.
This story has not transpired. What, in today's environment, what makes you think that the story that you're describing will transpire and results in results? I guess I'll say it because, again, the same, I've heard very similar stuff about emerging market equity. And it hasn't happened. And so what about today is different that you think that this will actually work for small caps?
Well, a couple of things. I think it is already working for small caps, as you can see by this chart right here.
It's worked for, I'll push on that. It's worked for EM for a quarter. For 2 quarters, it's right. What we're seeing now. It's working for a quarter or two. What makes you think it's a sustainable trend, I guess I'll say?
Well, yeah. Again, I go back to this small versus large chart, and this is 20 years. That trend has been working for 20 years. It does have its volatility. I think with emerging markets, a couple of things have impeded them. One, I think you're dealing with emerging market currencies, whether it's the Brazilian real, whether it's the South African rand, whether it's Indian rupee. Those currencies have been problematic due to fiscal problems, due to political problems in those countries. You don't necessarily have that in the small cap in the national space. The yen, you know, it has weakened. It's strengthening a bit now. The euro is strengthening a bit now. So you also have a time period right now, which I think you are going to see a relatively weaker dollar versus euros versus yen versus other currencies. So I think that will be somewhat supportive. I don't expect a big decrease in the dollar from now going forward, but I think that will help. But, you know, when you take a look at our strategy and you take a look at this, where's our 25-year, our 24-year track record? Let's just put that one up. You see that this is an asset class that has delivered, despite many of the challenges that are out there. Just one more. So this is the full long-term track record of the composite strategy. And you see that over 25 years, it's compounded about 11.72%. That's 280, gross fees versus benchmark. I guess I can't quite see that far. But, 380 versus the benchmark. So this is a strategy that's been able to beat the benchmark over 25 years by almost 380 basis points. And those absolute returns are nothing to, you know, shake a stick at. I think they're pretty strong. So this small cap international, I think, has done well. Emerging has had more challenges, and I think it's around the geopolitical risk that you're taking in these countries. I think it's also around many of these countries are buying on commodity exports, whether it's precious metals, whether it's grains and agriculture, and then also the political aspect has been problematic, whether it's again Argentina, whether it's what you're seeing in Latin America.
How much do you say, I guess first, is China considered an emerging market still?
Yeah.
What do you see from the debt side of China? Because there's been, and not on a tangent here, but I've done a lot of personal research into the levels of China.
I'm going to speak up, Tom.
Oh, yeah. I've done a lot of personal research into the debt levels of China, and what we're seeing is, especially on the municipal level, a very large surge in debt reported or otherwise. What do you see as, or how do you interpret the debt situation in China, and how might that affect your strategy, and how best are you in those kind of local markets?
Sure. So, you know, China has a debt problem. The U.S. has a debt problem. They're both big problems. When we look at China, which is probably 2 or 3% of our index, it's very small. So it's not really a problem we have to worry about. But if China, as if the U.S. has a debt default, there's going to be big repercussions globally. That's no doubt. When we look at China, you know, we have 2 or 3 investments there that we think are very interesting and, again, not going to be dependent on the debt situation. One of them is a data center called DDS. DDS basically provides all the computing power for Alibaba, Tencent, and all the hyperscalers that are doing business in China that have very strong growth ramp-up curves that will, we believe, continue to demand more and more data and compute power going forward, whether there's a debt issue or no debt issue. The second business we own is a business called Bosideng. Bosideng makes, do you guys know, also the puffer jackets like Moncler? That's a brand, a luxury brand, puffer jacket. They make winter clothing. You go ski, use them for high fashion. It's really a Chinese champion brand. So China, one of the things they're trying to do is not buy Western brands. They want to develop their own champions. So this is an aspiring luxury brand that's being built by a company that was very, it's interesting. The genesis of the company was that they provided initially the down for all the comforters and eiderdowns and all the blankets that were built and supplied to the West. Then they started making their own jackets. Then they started opening up their own stores when they saw how much margin they could capture. So this is a business that's starting to really gain traction in China and starting to, you know, really grow irregardless of the debt.
I guess a follow-up question.
Go ahead.
How many of your other countries, small cap businesses that you're invested in? Is dependent on the manufacturing exports.
So, you know, it's an interesting topic. I mean, there's one company in particular I'll highlight. It's a business called Breville. Breville is an Australian brand, and they make coffee machines, toasters, toaster ovens, tea kettles, and the like. And almost 100% of the production has been in China. They've realized that's a threat. They've realized they have to diversify, and they're making that right now into finding production capabilities in Southeast Asia and also in Mexico. So that's what they're doing. So generally, most of these businesses that have exposure are probably going to be in the consumer discretionary space where they're moving their chain out of China. So it's maybe 10% of the portfolio, rough guess. It's very hard to approximate that, but it's getting less and less by the day. Now, the other thing that where it does get tough for us is that you never know what the tariff's going to be, and you never know if it's going to be a sustainable tariff or not. So, you know, one of the things, you know, we spoke to Restoration Hardware, the U.S. small cap furniture manufacturer, and they had a big chunk of their furniture being made in China. You know, they looked to go to India. All of a sudden, India got tariffed, you know. So it's a very dynamic moment right now. But again, you know, what we're seeing is the administration bargaining with India to say, okay, don't buy gasoline or petroleum from Russia, and we'll lower the tariff. So there is a bit of earnings volatility right now because of that. But, you know, when we go back and we look at, you know, types of businesses that we're investing in, you know, there many of them are very local types of businesses. There's nothing that's tariff immune, but you know, very well tariff protected.
You've got about 10, 12 minutes, so I want to be sure we haven't taken you off your path if there are things you want to share that are there. Go ahead. Right. Yeah.
Okay, I guess I was saying, I think it's important. Are you all getting the questions that you have about the portfolio, performance, prospects, and things like that?
Good point. Yeah. My sense is yes. I think this has been a good discussion.
Yeah.
But I also want to be sure if there's stuff that these folks want us to hear that they're going to have time to do it.
I think the most important thing to really take out of this meeting is that we think small caps have had a rough patch over the last 5 years. We think a lot of that has been driven by the interest rate cycle. We think that interest rate cycle has peaked and is heading downward. That's very positive for small caps versus large caps. It's more positive for growth, we think, versus value, which should ultimately come back in favor of our strategy. We think that there is going to be a lot more geopolitical noise, a lot of macro noise. But I think what one has to do is focus on the businesses that we're investing in and focus on the businesses that we believe can deliver that revenue and earnings.
So you mentioned Restoration Hardware, and they go to China, mm-hmm. they go to India, and, you know, the tariff thing is back and forth, and we have an administration that seems consumed by a deal a day. This constant back and forth. At some point, does a company like Restoration Hardware, do the changes get ahead of their strategy and they crater because they can't keep up with, we moved to India, now that's bad. And, you know, their time frame for opening a new factory is like this, and the time frame for a change in the tariffs is like this. Does that start to happen?
There will be casualties. Okay. There certainly will be casualties.
Okay.
One of the things we do, though, is, you know, we're screening out companies that are decelerating their earnings growth rates. We screen out companies that are subject to major controversies or tariffs. So that's not going to really be in our investable pool. So we're really looking to find businesses that are in any given period showing potential for revenue acceleration, revenue earnings, acceleration and improvement. One of the things we think we are pretty good at is that earnings revision slide. I said I would want to work on page 40 here. One of the things that we have been able to do over time consistently, and this slide on the top is showing the percentage of earnings revisions in the portfolio over a 12-month period of the portfolio in dark green versus the index in greenish color. Over all these time periods, you see that we have populated the portfolio in 3Q25, 59% of the portfolio has been with companies with positive earnings revisions. The index is at 34%. More importantly, on the bottom of the slide, when you look at the change in earnings revisions over a 12-month period, so that's a 12-month look back, and you look at on each of these specific periods, the portfolio that you're invested in, in 3Q23 has had a 14% upward earnings revision over the 12 months. Prior quarter 14, prior quarter 17, prior quarter that 16%. And what I do is I look at the delta between what that's done versus what the index has done. And you're seeing that, you know, 14, 15, 15, 13, these are all companies that are starting to show positive earnings revisions versus the benchmark. So that's ultimately what we're trying to accomplish here is businesses that are going to surprise the upside. One of the businesses that we invested in Germany called Friedrich Furberg. This is a German consultancy company. And what they do is they do all the architecture all the engineering to establish all the piping for natural gas, for power supply, to be piped within Europe. And this is a business that just reported this week had a 25% upward revision to its earnings growth because of what's going on right now in Europe. So you have this geopolitical mess, but, you know, what is Europe trying to do? They're trying to cut their association from Russia, and they're trying to build a new network of power, a new grid. And there's a huge opportunity right now in Europe to do this. And it doesn't matter if there's tariffs. It doesn't matter if there's geopolitical issues. This is actually good. I mean, the other area that's been a huge beneficiary, you know, are, you know, it's really called the tanks and banks trade. So anything in defense in Europe has seen a huge ramp up in orders, a huge ramp up in outlook. The European defense budget is doubling from 2% to 4 or 5% of GDP. And that's going to be a multi-decade investment in infrastructure, in defense, in everything from drone production to tank production. You know, we own two businesses, one in Korea called Hyundai Rotem that makes actual tanks. In Germany, we own a business called Renk. Renk makes the transmissions and distribution systems for powering heavy vehicles, whether it's tanks, whether it's ships. This is business that's seen their backlogs and their orders explode. I should say increase rapidly. Not a good terminology for a defense company, but there's been a huge ramp up in this. And yeah, you have macro issues, but there are ways to find that growth opportunity.
And you say you own these businesses. Give us a sense for what's the typical percentage that you. Your share of any given company, what's the range?
It often depends, obviously, on the size of the company.
Sure.
I would say that on average, we're probably $30 million per company, $30 million to $50 million stake per company.
And what is that? What percentage is that of a typical company's capital?
Well,
what's the range?
It ranges from maybe 3% to lower. We're taking minority stakes.
All right.
We're not taking.
I don't mind just saying Zion, but I wanted to be sure. Oh, yeah. You're not in a position to deal with management regarding their decisions or anything.
We don't.
Small minority player, but a significant amount.
Correct.
So if you look at the weighted average market cap of your portfolio is around $6 billion, and we're taking, on average, let's say $30 million stakes.
Yeah. Okay.
What's the largest country?
That's biggest share.
The biggest weight?
Yeah, the biggest weight.
Probably Canada, I would think.
Right? Canada is around 15% of the portfolio. That would probably be the largest.
And then if you go to look, we have an allocation.
So that's like U.S. with public health.
No guns.
If you take a look at page 46, it gives you a breakdown of how we're allocated today in those regions. When you say country, I mean, Europe is, you know, quite a big allocation for us. It's 31, but obviously there's multiple countries in there. When you take a look at the emerging markets, it's about 28%. We're underweight relative to the benchmark there.
Then Japan, I guess, technically would be, we're modestly underweight, but that's around 20%.
Okay. What has been the experience the last couple of years in Israel? Have you seen depressed situation?
Israel has been incredible.
It's incredibly bad.
One of the good.
Oh.
It's been one of the best performing markets this year, believe it or not.
Really?
Surprisingly, yeah. And I don't want to say I'm fired, but it's been a very strong performer. I guess the war there has been a stimulus. But what you've seen there as well is you've seen a preponderance of startups. You've seen a preponderance of AI companies. Yeah. There are a couple of Israeli types of businesses in the portfolio. When you take a look at Nova. Nova is a metrology company that is essentially the first part of the AI food chain. So when you're making an NVIDIA chip, you're measuring the chips, you're checking the quality of the chips. Their instrumentation is pretty crucial for that. when you take a look at, you know, the local market has done pretty well with the insurance companies and the banks actually doing pretty well. War is actually, fortunately, a stimulative effect there. So there has been more spending that's had to happen that has driven some of that international, that domestic economy. And
CyberArk
was a business that was acquired at a very nice premium by Palo Alto, cybersecurity company that was in the portfolio. That's another thing I would also mention is that for the first time in 5 years, we're starting to see M&A really pick up again. And we're also starting to see IPOs pick up again, which is a sign that, you know, things are bottoming, or things are, you know, getting to be at more attractive levels. So, you know, for us, Israel has been probably one of our better attribution markets.
Is there a reason why you haven't, any particular reason why you haven't invested in the five countries that have zero?
Where are we here?
Belgium to Singapore?
No
decision not to invest in those countries.
It's not a forced decision.
Okay.
It's Saudi Arabia. I don't believe that's a different.
There may not be any.
That's a pretty difficult market there. South Africa opportunity set is just not attractive, and they've also had major currency issues. Belgium's just too tiny. I mean, there's no problems there.
I have another question.
Yes.
It seems like you have a pretty thick strategy. That's a fair way to say. Very focused on your strategy. Have a lot of belief in your strategy. Has American Century considered having multiple strategies to be able to adapt to the macro condition? It seems like we're entering a phase where we're at an inflection point, your strategy is set to perform well. But for the next cycle, when the stuff's coming back down, have you guys considered buffering your strategy or branching out to handle those environments perhaps better than?
Okay. Well, two things I'd say there. I think, first of all, on the strategy level, we've done and made a lot of changes to try to be more understanding of what's going on in the macro world. So we work very closely with quantitative analysts, my team, and we try to understand the factors that are driving the markets. We try to understand why is value working, why is growth working, why is beta working, what are all the factors driving that market. We're also looking at, some of the geopolitical issues and some of the macro issues in industry directions, and then trying to make sure that we're correctly positioned from that perspective. So we've made some internal improvements. I mean, this is a business about being humble, being nimble, and being, very, very observant of what is actually happening, changing. So we've done a lot in terms externally. American Century, in the small cap space, we probably have over $30 billion of different types of assets investing in the small cap universe, whether it's small cap value, U.S. small cap, different approaches. So there are, quite a bit of other vehicles to use. But, again, I think that this strategy here is one where we've gone through 4 or 5 years of just very tough headwinds, and we haven't seen a 500 basis point rate increase in my career, at least. We haven't seen a Russia-Ukraine war, a Middle East war all happening at once. Who knows what's going to happen in the future? But, we do see a lot of the clouds clearing, and we do see a lot of opportunity set ahead of us.
Any more questions? Well, anything to wrap up? Sounds like maybe you just did.
I think that is probably what I would conclude with. Just, again, reiterating good growth, good valuation, and what we think is a supportive economic environment for growth of small caps over the next 3 to 5 years.
Well, thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Traveling out here to Tucson. So. better than wherever you were.
It is.
We brought some slightly cooler weather for today.
Oh, it feels great to us. But thank you for having. I'd like to say the weather is great to us. But yeah, thank you again for having us. And we're here as a resource. We're here anytime. Reach out to us. Again, I'm the dedicated relationship manager. So anytime you want to have access to these guys, you do. We're happy to hop on a call and answer any other questions. Even after you continue your meetings today, I know you've got a packed agenda. So, you know, if there's other questions that come up afterwards, we're here for you. So,
thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks for all the questions.
Yes.
So let's take 5 minutes if anybody needs to run to the restroom and stretch legs.
Or get something to eat.
Here's the garage number. The license plate tag and service box. And they asked
for the so much.
I would have taken care of it for you, but I didn't know your phone number.
Oh. Okay, but I'll just do that.
That's not there yet.
I wonder if that's just highlighting that there was a gap, because we did have somebody who carried he tends to keep getting to the limit. This may be what you want to be a Jesse item, but I don't know. Okay. I remember that that election was called at the gate. So we may, we have somebody. Can you tell her about the replacement? Okay. I know she was very sick. Jesse.
But you always do the same year.
So I think the last time, 2 or 3 years ago, depends on how many members we've got.
I'm glad that you doing
I don't know.
the last some 75 years.
There's a new one from the bar. Maybe we do some great
This is what I'm doing.
Thank you so much.
8%. It's better because of the definition.
I'm from Houston.
There's like a separate.
Yeah.
This right here, do you know why this was held in 25?
Yes, because I wanted it. Okay.
So, if there's an
out,
that's so she just kind of felt like, I thought she had a lecture. No, she was my lecture. So Jack was appointed to do somebody else. So that's well, from what the public is saying,
And Jeff was not elected. You don't have any records of Jeff's spot.
He was just,
okay, that makes sense. Because I do remember.
Yes. We could discuss it.
You can give him a heads up because that's something we should. I would give him a heads up of what's happening.
Okay, let's not. We'll table it then.
Yes. No, I would give him a heads up. But
okay,
maybe
we'll talk about it.
Okay.
So she knows.
Oh, okay.
Thank you.
I was thinking of seeing you all the time.
I should look at the assets before you ask.
Pardon me?
So let me look at the assets before you ask that as well. So you've got Champlain here. They are your mid-cap equity manager. They've got, about 3.2% of total portfolio assets. I would say as a whole in the U.S., small and mid-cap is in a very tough place to be for active managers. Talked about a little bit about that during the last presentation. But again, similar to what we just heard, we thought it'd be good for you all to hear directly from them what's going on with the organization, results, and what things look like moving forward. So I'll let them introduce themselves.
Okay.
But again, mid-cap, U.S. mid-cap.
Take it away.
Thank you for the introduction, Craig, and thank you all for inviting us out here. This used to be an annual meeting that Champlain would attend back in the day, but we've been here in almost 10 years, so it's nice to meet you all in person and and to put some faces with some names. My name is Meg O'Brien. I'm a principal on the client service team at Champlain. I've been with the organization for more than 15 years. And we just want to thank you for your long tenured partnership. We recognize that you all have been clients since 2010 and one of the earlier clients in our mid-cap strategy. So thank you for that. We are headquartered out in Burlington, Vermont, and I'll move forward just to some key attributes of the firm here. So as the firm was originally established as an employee-owned firm, we maintain that today. We're 100% employee-owned. We're strong believers in the owner-operator model here at the firm. We have 16 current employee partners and 4 retired individuals that hold the equity of the firm. Last year, we sold.
You owned by ESOP, or just the employees happen to be the owners?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. We celebrated our 20th anniversary last year, but our track record for our strategy, for our small cap strategy, actually dates back to 1996, when the strategy was initially architected by our CIO, Scott Brayman, who remains the CIO today. And though there's been evolution in the execution of the process itself has not changed since it was initially architected. We follow the same investment process with the same discipline in execution. The team manages the process together. So I'll just move forward to our organizational chart just for a moment here. So although the investment team is segmented by individual sector coverage, the team does come together to make all buy and sell decisions on the strategies. Our sole focus is on U.S. small and mid-cap equities. We only have one process and one team that manages our strategies. Something else to highlight about the investment team here is that although they are segmented by individual sector coverage, their compensation is based on overall firm performance. We don't want any individual throwing a Hail Mary at the end of the year to meet any expectations. So the team's compensation is highly dependent on overall firm performance. Additionally, our code of ethics restricts investment in the asset classes where we invest. And the only way that we can gain access to these asset classes is by being invested alongside our clients within our strategies that they manage. All members of the investment team are co-invested in the strategies that they oversee. We're very proud of our long tenured client relationships, including with Tucson Supplemental Retirement System. Our average client tenure is 12 years, and within the mid-cap strategy specifically, it's greater than 10 years. Although there have been changes to the investment team over the tenure of your investment within the mid-cap strategy, the structure has remained the same with individual sector coverage. Our goal is to have 2 sets of eyes on the sectors where the investment team finds their opportunities and invests. Since 2010, like I said, there's been some additions to the team. There's also been some retirements. One thing I'd like to highlight is that in 2022, I believe, Corey Bronner here and Joe Caligiri, which are long-term members of the investment team, were promoted to deputy CIO, and they share that role together and work alongside our CIO, Scott Brayman, in management of the team and strategies. That was everything I wanted to highlight about the firm. I'm happy to answer any questions that you all may have before turning it over to Corey to really get to the meat of the discussion.
So aside from the maybe you all deputy CIOs, have there been any other meaningful team changes, updates in the last 3 to 5 years?
Not 3 years. 5 years, really, we brought on some junior talent, really right during COVID. So it was 2020 when Rachel Dragan joined us and Ethan Ellison joined us. They have both kind of moved up the ladder. Ethan was an experienced hire to help us in industrials. Remember, I said we like to have 2 sets of eyes in every sector. When Joe and I were promoted to deputy CIO, it was kind of recognition that we've taken on a lot of additional responsibility, and so we've had to backfill some of our day-to-day responsibilities on the team. So I think it's more filling out the bench than really transformational changes.
Additionally, Scott Brayman, our CIO, no longer has any individual sector coverage. That's been backfilled as well with some of these junior roles.
Maybe quickly at a higher level, you know, when you're talking about the ownership, can you repeat what you said? Because I think I had a question about it.
Yeah, so we've always been 100% employee owned. There was some private equity backing in the early days that the founding partner were able to buy back relatively quickly because of the success of the firm. As we've gone along, we are not an ESOP per se, but we do want all key members of the team to have equity ownership. We think that creates the best alignment. So the founding partners have been very intentional transitioning equity to what we kind of call the next generation.
So how many people have equity? What's the biggest share that's being?
The biggest shares are still owned by Judy and Scott, being the majority of the firm. The retired partners have transitioned about 60% of their equity. So that's kind of who we've been buying equity back from and transitioning that to newer partners. So at this point, over 30% of the economics of the firm have been transitioned, but it's just a long process. So we do a little bit every year.
And the equity is distributed across all departments at the firm as well, not just solely within the investment team.
Is there a plan to further diversify that across time? What does that look like?
Yeah, I think the founding partners recognize that your assets ride the elevator every day, right? It's a people-led organization and relatively small one at that. So it behooves everyone to make sure that the economics are shared appropriately with the people at the elevator. So they've been very gracious transitioning that equity. There's kind of an internal buyback that happens every year, like I mentioned, and it's pretty prescriptive. So that plan is to keep happening.
Acoustics in the room are not great.
Oh, sorry.
And I may do this as well.
Yeah.
Remember them.
I generally talk pretty loud, too, so it must really be bad.
You're okay. Keep going. Okay.
Turn it over to you, Corey.
Yeah, so we thought, my name is Corey Bronner, co-deputy CIO. I've also been at Champlain more than 15 years now. So I started as an analyst covering just financials and consumer as well. And I led both of those sectors in part because of retirements around the 2015 time period. And I was named co-deputy CIO in 2022. So been here for more of Champlain's history than not, and I'm certainly pleased to be here at Arizona, so this is the first for me, and looking forward to a kind of productive conversation. We thought we'd learn or start by just helping you learn or understand how we manage money or why we do it the way that we do it, and then we will go into performance, and recognize performance is probably topic du jour and the thing that probably requires the most conversation. So I'll try to make the overview here relatively quick, but please stop me if you need further explanation at any step of the process. Now, Meg mentioned that this process has not changed since the mid-90s, for better or worse. We still believe today the best way to manage clients' money is by following this process, and it starts with these goals. The first goal is simply just to make money. Not trying to be flip with that. A lot of people on Wall Street are highly sensitive or focused on relative performance. We understand that that's how we'll get judged, but we also can't help clients meet their liabilities if at the end of the day, we're not delivering absolute returns in the real sense. We think the biggest impediment to making money over the long term are actually losses. So we think managing risk is as important as getting that 100 times or 10x return on individual investment. There are two things that are within our control when it comes to risk that we can manage. The first is business model risk. So we're big believers that not all businesses are created equal. And the first step of our process is actually just to cut off the long tail of hard to manage, difficult, cyclical businesses that generally require an element of timing in a market cycle. The second risk within our control is what we pay for businesses, because you can still lose a lot of money if you buy a great business. Plenty of people in 99, 2000 buying Coke and the other Warren Buffett favorites at 40, 50 times earnings. You didn't see those prices again for 10 years. So focus on quality, focus on good businesses, but make sure you don't overpay. If we manage those two risks, we think we can limit the probability of large losses and ultimately help clients make. Finally, being consistent. I mentioned same process as 1996. We've seen a lot of cycles at this point. We know that good businesses at a reasonable price are the best way to manage through long market cycles. Maybe not always short market cycles. We'll get into that. But I think it's important to note that this team manages this process the same way that today that we did pre-COVID, that we did pre-financial crisis. Scott, he was really a one-man team back in 1996, but that it was managed then. Moving on to the next page. This philosophically, I kind of already touched on this. A lot of words on this page, but it boils down to buying a good business at a reasonable price. Why we think that's a better philosophy is that it gives you multiple ways to make money. So with a tough business, pretty much you have to get the timing right. The series of events has to go right for the stock price to work. That's called just buying low and selling high. And that certainly can happen with a good business as well. But our favorite outcome is actually the middle bullet point on the bottom of this page, where management of a great business just grows that business every year at a compound rate that the market never really comes around to or bids up in a way that makes it look like a high-flying stock. But you look back after 10 years, and those are some of the best performers in the portfolio. So those steady kind of compounding machines. And then finally, a good business, if you're not paying or overpaying for it, it's probably no surprise that other people would covet that business as well. So we do like to have the optionality of our companies getting acquired, whether by a larger company or private equity, sometimes management themselves. But again, it's a little bit of a fallback, but another way, and it gives clients multiple ways to benefit from an individual stock picking decision. Simplistically, on the next page, what we're trying to do with each individual position, stock price trades at the blue line, right? So just pretend that that's a typical stock. At any given time, a company actually has a fair or intrinsic value. So we spend a lot of time calculating what we think that is for each company. And what we want to find are the stock prices trading below what that fair or intrinsic value is. And then as the stock price approaches that fair value, we will often be trimming back the position. Fair value, there is no answer as to what fair value is. It is an art, and it's open to interpretation. So that's why it's shaded a little bit around that idea of fair value, because as a stock is approaching it, maybe your fair value is moving higher, and so you don't want to completely remove exposure. But I think importantly, the idea that as a stock price moves above what you think the fair value is, the further it goes, the more likely that we're going to be moving on and kind of reallocating that capital to something else, trading in the green zone. So as managers of the strategy, what we're always trying to do is recycle from the red into the green, build a bigger weighted average discount to that fair value at the portfolio level, and ultimately that's what drives your long-term absolute returns. Finally, I think as it relates to the process, just like how do you go from an opportunity set of hundreds, maybe as much as 1,000 of stocks down to a portfolio of 50 to 75 holdings? The most important step on this page are what we call our sector factors. And they were derived by Scott early in his career. For better or worse, he had kind of an obsession or kind of an annual curiosity around the Forbes 400 list of richest people in the country. And what he noticed early in his career was that certain individuals were on that list every year, never seemed to fall off. And then other individuals were on the list, off the list, on the list, off the list. And that their own personal wealth was highly cyclical. And it might have been oil related, real estate related, metals and mining related. But there was something about it that it didn't matter how good a manager or an individual you were when it came to investing. It was ultimately out of your control. You benefited when oil prices were up. In real estate, you benefit when interest rates are low and development strong. But at the end of the day, what he noticed most was there are certain businesses where once they got on that list, they basically never relinquished it because the businesses that the wealth was derived from were just so good. So he took those lessons and he looked at the stock market and he said, well, where do you find those permanent pools of wealth creation? What you'll see in the sector factors are only five sectors. There are 11 sectors as measured by the global industry classification system, which is kind of the thing we all live by. So right away, basically eliminated energy, what used to be telecommunications, utilities, real estate, as areas of the market that were fickle and highly prone to government regulation, used leverage, were low returning, and instead focused on these five major areas of the economy. And then within each one, basically created qualitative screen to direct him as important as where it directs you to is what it helps you avoid. So, for instance, in consumer, the idea that the great consumer wealth stories the last 100 years are mostly concentrated in companies that you and I would all agree have very high brand loyalty. So within the portfolio today, we own McCormick. McCormick is four times bigger than the next spice company in the spice aisle of the grocery store. It's basically a monopoly. Most of us, they own so many brands that you might not even think you're buying McCormick, but you probably are buying a McCormick product. And at this point, that relationship with the consumer is almost unbreakable. And we would, that makes it so much easier to manage that business as opposed to going out there and having to compete tooth and nail against, a highly competitive category. Brand loyalty basically keeps us away from what we call fashion risk. So the companies where the value proposition is, you might have a product like a Yeti cooler, right? It's a flash in the pan. It's good for the moment. I always found it funny because, your Yeti cooler's so well built. You'll never have to buy a second one if you don't want to, right? They're almost obsoleting themselves with each sale. They moved on to cups and to other things, but at the end of the day, it's a product that is there's not a ton of brand loyalty. It's a kind of a thing you need at a moment. So focus on the McCormick to the world, that brand loyalty, avoid the fashion risks, the fads, the trends. It tends to lead us to consumer staples companies like McCormick and away from the more cyclical cruise line operators, home builders, the things that are credit dependent and, like I said, highly fickle. In an area like technology, so limiting obsolescence risk, technology is very hard if every time you sell a product, somebody's out there trying to make it better, cheaper, faster. Think of a TV, think of a camera, I think the phone is kind of the exception to the rule that Apple has done, but I think that's actually probably built around their software component. But anyway, the alternative of obsolescence risk is, in our minds, software and enterprise software. So companies that build their businesses around a platform, you come in every day, you live and breathe, you're trained on that platform to do your specific job, and the idea of changing it is probably a once in a decade type conversation. So we've always had a heavy overweight of software at the expense of tech hardware. So these can be hard to visualize. What the intent, though, is to winnow the pool and limit the most difficult to manage businesses. What we have found over time is that the application of these qualitative screens, again, you can't go code this into a system and have it spit out a bunch of opportunities. It's really on the analysts to apply this. But when we do apply it, we find that we eliminate almost two-thirds of the industries that are out there. So it keeps us highly focused on still a diverse and the large share of the economy, is represented on this list. But as an analyst, it really focuses attention and reduces that idea of business model risk right off the bat. Then the next step of the process, as an analyst, you go in. You get to know the company. We want high returning companies. We do not like leverage. Quality earnings just means that the company generates cash flow as opposed to, the promise of cash flow some period of time in the future. And sincere and capable management, that's really important to us. We get to know the management teams. We get to know the board of directors. We think we're already operating from an advantaged position there because We imagine good management likes to go to good businesses, and so if we're starting the process by focusing on good businesses, it probably stands to reason that good management finds its way there. So our management teams are generally less prone to capital destruction through bad M&A, unnecessary or unproductive CapEx. And so, you know, they're running the businesses at the end of the day, so that's a big step of the process for us. And then finally, we talked about valuation. I don't think we're kind of recreating the wheel or doing anything that a lot of our competitors aren't doing on valuation, but I think it's about being in the ballpark of right, been doing it, again, for a long time, and we know the quality of our valuation where it can. We get periodic M&A, which can confirm or dispute your conclusions around fair value, but generally we have found that we're in the ballpark of what the M&A would imply fair value as it could indicate to this. So, you know, this manage the business model risk, focus on good companies, don't overpay for them, and then some loose portfolio construction guidelines. We're not allowed to have any more than 25% in one of those five major sectors. We do like to stay relatively concentrated, so only 50 to 75 holdings. And then we do give ourselves a little bit of leniency on how big the holdings in the portfolio can grow to. So you will see a couple companies over time that maybe look more like they're large cap. But that's because they've grown into that. So that's generally a good outcome. Our guidelines keep us in the mid-cap space at initiation. So when you do see that, it's generally just a sign that things have gone well.
Is that a development that happened over time, or is that something that's been?
That's been a lesson learned over time. So we used to have a hard non cutoff. We realized that the stock market is an appreciating thing, so nominal numbers tend to be restrictive. We also realized that we had really, really good situations that maybe by guideline, I think, to sell them, but in terms of making clients money, we left money on the table. So over time, this has worked. The biggest change was probably when we went from the nominal number. And just for perspective, that number 10 plus years ago was $15 billion. So that was the high end of what we took hold. The high end of the Russell mid-cap now is $75 billion. So the index itself has inflated considerably over the last 10 years.
So what you're saying is a company with a market value of $15 billion was your, at that point, you were, when you had a hard cut.
It was a relatively hard cut, yes.
So you would be selling when it reached $15 billion.
Yeah, we gave ourselves a little bit of wiggle room saying if it hadn't reached fair value yet, we didn't have to.
Okay.
But if it was over $15 billion and then it hit fair value, we had to move on from it.
Okay.
And that was, again, just in a nominal or an inflationary world, numbers generally become restrictive eventually.
So you're making the decision to perhaps leave some money on the table so you have money for other opportunities that might actually generate more money.
I don't think that's necessarily now or then.
I don't know.
Yeah.
That's what I heard from you have a hard cutoff.
So now it basically comes down to clients are going to measure us against the benchmark. The benchmark does not care about a nominal high end. Like Palantir last year was a mid-cap stock that grew to $250 billion in market cap just the last 12 months. So from 50 to 250. If we had had a hard cutoff, we didn't hold it, unfortunately, at the end. But if we had had a hard cutoff and had to sell at 75, but in our minds, we thought, oh, there's upside here. It would have been a disservice to clients to sell it just because of a nominal construction guideline. If we had some sort of insight that it's going to go a lot higher. So unfortunately, we did not own that one. And we can get into that if we want to. But it's indicative of potentially unnecessary constraint that you can put on yourself that disadvantages you versus that which you're getting measured against, which isn't exactly fair.
I think I would add quickly, market capitalizations are very flexible. So in terms of how people define what the capitalization ranges are, there's no definition of what they are. They change. Over time, they change depending on the index that you're talking about. Sometimes they change based on the person or the manager that you're talking to. And so I do think having inherent flexibility is potentially a benefit, because it doesn't force you to the point, you know, I think that's being made, is it doesn't force you into positions where you're having to make decisions that are almost more arbitrary than anything else, just because they say this is the number, even if the market or, you know, the benchmark recognizes it as something different.
Yeah. But I think what I'm hearing in all of this is that you're not necessarily, even now with flexibility, intending to hold the stock until you think it has reached its maximum value. You're prepared to walk away in the right situation,
yeah,
and with some remaining opportunity for that stock.
With any stock, almost irrespective of size, if we don't think there's upside, we are considering reallocating that capital to something where we think there is upside.
But if you see upside over time, and you believe you have other opportunities as well, you're not necessarily going to hold that stock because you have to know it in order to maximize that potential upside. Or am I got, or do I have that?
Well, I mean, every decision is complicated. So if there was two companies that were the exact same quality with the exact same discount to fair value, I hold a little bit of both of them. If those two companies, one was trading close to fair value and one was at a big discount, say 20, 25%, we would 100% be considering taking all of this one and putting more.
That's what I'm hearing. You're not wedded to a stock because you already own it.
No.
That's what I was looking for.
And okay. That's actually been, even in the last years, something that we've been trying to get better at, is not anchoring to things just because you own them. Treat them like pieces of paper, because the best thing for clients might be to sell that stock, even if it's at a discount, because something else presented that is just more attractive.
We're not wired that way. The status quo plays a big part of the wiring.
100%. And yeah. When we get into performance, we'll talk a little bit about how when things were going extremely well for Champlain in 2021, it was the best performance we'd ever had. We were behaviorally caught up in that. So we didn't do things that we probably should have done in 2021 with regards to selling positions that were up significantly near fair value and being a little bit too concentrated. So we're always trying to get better. We're in the 100% of the mind that continuous improvement, but the behavioral element of investing for everybody is your biggest enemy. It's very hard.
Yeah. That's what I was looking for. Thanks.
So I think on pages 15 and 16, I'll just touch on these really quickly because the sector factors can be hard to conceptualize. But what we have here are some of the big industries and sectors that we just choose to avoid. And so the green line is semiconductors. So for the first, you know, 10 years of Champlain, call it 8 years of your all's experience with us, we were not punished by not owning semiconductors because semiconductors are highly cyclical. They're very much dependent on the macro economy. What's happened since 2020 is that some of the areas of the market that we purposefully avoid, like semiconductors, like construction and engineering, like metals and mining, have, for generally macro reasons, become wildly in vogue. And you can see that red line, the construction engineering one. It's just wild that after 15 years, all of a sudden construction engineering has had kind of an unprecedented backdrop, starting with COVID, starting with the, you know, the home price appreciation, the immigration movements within this country, and now really supercharged by data center construction and AI.
Is the ballroom at the White House factored in?
Maybe. Government involvement definitely has something to do with that. The important thing, though, is that a lot of these lines through history, so this is just the performance of those parts of the market. It has nothing, like there's no stock picking from us involved in this. For most of their history, these parts of the market have been volatile and relatively underperformed. The black line, the zero line, is what the market has done. So think of these lines as relative. The last 3-5 years have been highly different in that these cyclical parts of the market have had a tailwind from $7 trillion of post-COVID stimulus, that we just had never seen before. It dwarfs what happened in the great financial crisis in terms of stimulative effect. On page 16, again, just a visualization of why we think the front end, the sector factors put you in a better set of companies. Again, this is just the performance of these areas of the market that we prefer. So the green line, software, the red line, equipment and supplies within healthcare. The gray line is the machinery within the insurance or industrial space. So some of these lines have massively outperformed the benchmark, like software. Healthcare has still generally outperformed, though recently since COVID, it's been a little bit more of a slog. We'll get into that. But in general, you get less volatility and more of a structural tailwind in these industries versus the alternatives that we're trying to avoid. So I think long story short, when you think of our process, think of it as trying to put you all into industries and parts of the market that have secular or full market cycle type tailwinds at the expense of the difficult, cyclical, commodity-driven, interest rate-dependent, leveraged parts of the economy. Now that's what we're trying to do. Unfortunately, that posture has really hurt us the last 5 years.
Just for clarity, the scales on these two graphs are different, right?
So, right.
So what you're showing is actually showing higher performance for these relative to them.
Yeah, if we use this scale on the last page, it would kind of downplay some of the recent performance of those. That's what you meant. So.
Exactly.
I've actually got a better chart to kind of highlight the net impact of this posture later in the presentation. But I think the important thing is to jump into performance now. So page 18 has a lot of performance periods here. Unfortunately, you have to go to the 10-year performance number to see a net return for Champlain of 11.55% versus the benchmark at 11.38 to get to a relative outperformance for us. That feels tough. It feels like, you know, you've had almost 10 years relative underperformance. The relative underperformance is highly concentrated in the last 3 years. So it's a little bit dependent on where you start, where you end the conversation. But when we're talking about performance challenges, it's really the last 3.5 years where our process has been highly out of favor. We think there are things we could have done. I mentioned these earlier in the 2022 time period to blunt some of that impact. But even in our small cap strategy, where we haven't had some of the same headwinds as mid cap from an execution standpoint, performance is the worst that we've ever seen in a 3 year period. So there's an element to the market that is very much anti-Champlain right now. And I'm not trying to make excuses because we're competitive people. We want to outperform, but we also don't think we can outperform in every environment. And so I think it's important just to talk to you know what about this environment has been so hard for us to overcome. So, you know, table format is tough to kind of get perspective. We love a picture that says 1,000 different things. So each dot on this page is a 3 year performance period annualized. So the way to read this chart is along the bottom, you see what the benchmark has done. And then the vertical axis is our relative performance. So if a dot is falling above the horizontal axis, we have outperformed. If it falls below, we have underperformed. You see kind of a whole new bubble of dots, the most recent one being third quarter of 25. Below the line and below our historical experiences in similar market environments. You can't really talk about that period without talking about COVID 2020 and 2021. So if you go to 4Q21 up there on the right, just to read that dot, over the 3 year period ending December 2021, the market was compounding at 23-24% a year. So it was a very productive absolute return environment. We outperformed that by about 4% net of fees 8 year. So 400 basis points. For us in a growthy market like that, that was highly unprecedented. And it owed to the fact that everything that we liked that our process tells us we should like was in favor. Software coming out of COVID with everybody working from home, medical devices, all the money, all the investment going into vaccine development, highly efficacious environment for medical devices. We're all sitting at home. Nobody can go out to restaurants. Everyone's eating McCormick spices and at levels they were never eating them before. So consumer staples companies all of a sudden looked like hybrid stocks. So across the portfolio, we had these tailwinds that were creating, and some good stock selection, creating a level of outperformance that if we had had this meeting in the fourth quarter of 2021, we were telling clients, this is abnormal. There is likely a reversion to the mean here just because the market is always mean reverted. We did not expect to be on the other side of that cloud in such short order. So what happened in 2022, first because of inflation and interest rates, almost all of those parts of the market that we liked had gotten slightly overpriced, and that's the lesson I talked about. We were not quick enough to cut that valuation risk in a material way. We were doing it slowly, thinking that we'd have time to kind of, you know, reprime the pump, if you will. Instead, in 2022, software, medical devices, parts of consumer, from a valuation standpoint, when interest rates are rising, the most expensive things fall the furthest. So in a down market, we underperform, which is very unlike us. So that's when we're critical of the last 3 to 4 years. It's really those things we didn't do in 2021 when everything was going our way. And again, that behavioral element of, you know, it's going so good, let's be slow to try to, you know, fight the narrative, which
I was talking to the guys yesterday, and I when he was talking to me about trying to get them. So I think he's doing the best he can.
Hi, Terry. Terry, you may want to mute.
So one question. Did you see a sort of domain shift happening with software in the sense that before software companies themselves saw a lot of their own value with their own product in a sense, you know, like there was the race, and that's where the innovation was. You're starting to see more in the market that the users of that software are starting to expand that value, whether it's an engineering company or somewhere along that lines where they're doing more innovation on the application. And that may be some of what is driving now that, you know, through AI means access to kind of the back end and customization of things is a little bit more in the hands of the people buying.
There's definitely a fear in the market that software companies are basically being disintermediated by the consumer or the user's access to things like ChatGPT and large language models, that you could ask it to do things that previously you required an implementation from your existing software provider. The reason we have always focused on enterprise software is because the software itself often becomes the system of record. So it's a platform, right? So you can't access your human resource management information unless you're in that platform. They kind of own the data. So even if you want to apply AI to it, you still need that middleman to facilitate the cleanliness of the data to make sure that what you're kind of pointing the LLM at is in fact relevant, which is why our house view is that these platforms will be the conduits by which AI makes it to the workforce. It's going to be incredibly hard to just disintermediate them because of where they sit in the ecosystem. There's no doubt that there are a lot of features right now that were previously provided that AI is really good at doing better, and those features will get disintermediated or obsoleted. But that's why we tend to focus on the platforms that companies really build their day-to-day operation for that.
And was that platform focus a more recent development? Is that kind of a long-standing thing? Do you see that evolving?
No, it's been enterprise software has been a forever focus. The evolution will be the sensitivity to how critical that enterprise software is in the ecosystem. So if it, and AI is 12 months old, so nobody has any answer for AI. It will be incumbent on us to be the ones basically bring judgment to which companies are going to be better because of AI and which ones are going to be replaced by AI. And so there'll be a sensitivity to it maybe that would have us quicker to move on from things in the future. But I don't see the preference for enterprise software changing. In fact, in some ways it might be enhanced because, you know, when they released ChatGPT 5 a couple of years ago, one of the demonstrations on stage was Sam Altman asked it to create a language learning software that was game-based. And you could just watch as the AI created a game-based software. And it looked, smelled, felt exactly like Duolingo. So my kids are on Duolingo every day. Duolingo is a publicly traded company. Interestingly, Duolingo had reported earnings that morning, and the stock was doing really well. They had reported good earnings. And as the presentation went on, you just watched Duolingo stock plummet because people were sitting there thinking, well, is there anything that Duolingo is bringing to this conversation that the ChatGPT version didn't just obsolete? And the answer is no, because it's more, it's just a feature. It's not a core platform that basically is, you know, you're like, or rebar or concrete. It sits there and the whole company is built on it. That's what we think of.
That's good. Do you see that I think there's a lot of value in the avoiding losses.
Yeah.
That does not get captured with market reporting, because a lot of times you performance occurred with this, but we compare earning to earning loans, right? We compare more harshly on the upside as much as this person. When you're looking at the savings of what could have lost and compounded,
right?
Investments of that, do all of our investments as we're moving can you speak to that? Does the market punish people with that strategy just because of the nature of reporting? Just if you're not getting as deep of dips as you should.
So it certainly feels like there's been a bit of a regime change in the last few years around that topic. But if we bring it back to this chart, if you ignore the dots kind of in the bottom middle of the page, there was a very defined pattern of performance for Champlain, right? So in those really heady growth markets, we tended to underperform a couple hundred basis points. We were okay with it because the stuff that was working was stuff that we purposefully were avoiding. It was the left side of this chart when the market was compounding down 5, 10, 15% a year, and we are down 7, 8, 900 basis points less. So if you think of it like a pawl and a ratchet, right? Our strategy offered a downside protection, and then we didn't actually have to grow as much on the upside to create a better absolute return over the full market cycle. What's happened in the last 5 years is we've had this rolling series of basically 12 to 18 month cycles where, you know, COVID was bad and then COVID was really good. And then high interest rates were bad, and then Silicon Valley was bad. And now you have to have AI, quantum, and crypto exposure to have any hope about performing in this current environment. So very narrow performance. And to your point, less downside in periods where you would have expected an almost outright recession. I mean, for 2.5 years, we've been worried about a recession that just never came. But there were many recessions in different parts of the economy. So I think from our perspective, we're looking at these numbers, and yes, we've underperformed, but in many ways, the environment has not been conducive to us outperforming because of what's been in favor of that. That gets us to this next chart. So if we take all those squiggly lines from that prior page and we just add them together and we say, well, what's the benefit of owning, this is the green part of this chart, the sectors and industries that we do own, and what's the benefit of avoiding the sectors and industries that we avoid? Those are the yellow bars. So what you'll see through time is that in general, the things we prefer outperform, and the things we avoid underperform. And so we've got a tailwind from that posture for most of our history. There are brief moments like coming out of COVID where the yellow, coming out of the Great Financial Crisis in 2010, 2011, where the junkiest companies ripped. You've got things like cash for clunkers and, you know, the Federal Reserve, quantitative easing. And that could be a headwind, but it tends to be fleeting. We tend not to see the parts of the market we like ever really underperform. The last 3 years has been totally different. So first you see the 2021 spike where everything that we like is in favor. And then $7 trillion of stimulus, a high interest rate environment, President Trump. The last 3 years, both what we avoid has been a headwind, and what we like has been out of favor. And that's what, when we talk about a process headwind, you know, it's just been really hard for us to pick stocks in a way that could overcome this kind of starting block of performance. We do not look at this and feel like now is the time to be changing our process. Again, I mentioned earlier, we're big believers in reversion to the mean. We think this too shall end. And in many ways, we're focusing more on our process and doubling down, if you will, on things like high-quality companies, reasonable growth expectations, and again, always trading at a discount to fair value, recognizing that that is very much out of favor right now. I think if I were to just prove to you just the quality of the portfolio, if we go to, let's go to page 24. So we make a bunch of individual company decisions and it rolls up to a portfolio. And you can measure that portfolio. There's a lot of different definitions of quality out there. But what we have here are just a host of different factors that we would say are probably required in some way, shape, or form to qualify something as quality. The right side of the page, you see our current portfolio versus the benchmark. So as you look at the top quadrant there, free cash flow return on invested capital. For me, if you could focus on one thing over the long term, it would be owning companies that have higher free cash flow returns than companies that have lower free cash flow returns. Right now, the portfolio is at almost 16%. Benchmark's only 11%. We have a massive advantage at the portfolio level in terms of profitability for our companies. The middle of this chart shows you, the diamond shows you the current spread. The bars are the min and the max of that spread over the last 3 years. The circles are the average. So the middle of the page is just to highlight to you that a lot of these things, our portfolio, our advantages are actually building. In our minds, we're getting even higher quality relative to the benchmark. If you think growth is a sign of relevance, is a sign of quality, if you look at the bottom of the page, whether it's 12-month sales growth or 3-year sales growth, you know, we're growing 30, 40% faster than the benchmark. So again, you have a portfolio that's growing 30 to 40% faster than the benchmark, returning in terms of cash flow 30 to 40% more than the benchmark. Over time, this will drive absolute returns. Right now, nobody cares about fundamentals. Nobody cares about things like this because the only thing that matters in the market is AI, crypto, things like metals and mining. And the craziest one to me that's been the topic du jour, or not the topic du jour, but one of the most acute performing parts of the market is quantum computing, which is basically just a scientific project at this point. There is no, nobody has a quantum computer. Nobody has a use case for quantum computing. But you look at quantum computing stocks over the last 3 months, they're up 200, 300, 400, 500, 600%. We just will not ever participate with those because they're not real businesses yet. We always want to see real profits, real markets, real management teams. So we feel, at the end of the day, we feel at peace with the fact that we've underperformed because we don't think we ever would have outperformed. More importantly, the portfolio quality-wise by these metrics is the best it's ever been relative to the benchmark. So if these things matter again in the future, we think you all have a ton of exposure to them. I always get the question next, well, when will they matter? And I do not have a crystal ball there. I think the scary thing is that we're in that market environment where people are saying, yeah, we're in a bubble, but there's a lot of money to be made at the end of a bubble. In case of point, 1999, the stock market was up 82% than the NASDAQ was before it went on to fall 30% each of the next 3 years. That's a really dangerous game. Again, we're not letting that type of conversation influence our behavior. We're staying true to the businesses that we like. We're staying true to the valuation discipline. And we're not going to chase some of these market themes that have been massive headwinds.
Could you speak a little bit to Dunhill's and how you view the industrial?
Yeah, sure. So there's actually been a little bit of philosophical change with industrials, I'd say, in the last 2.5 years. Historically, we focused on what we called portfolio managers, or said another way, diversified industrials. So large cap Danaher was like the quintessential diversified industrial. Had a big healthcare exposure, had a big end market, pure industrials, even asset management. The market has basically left those types of companies behind. What the market kind of does this with conglomerates. There's like, they'll trade a premium and then a discount. In the last 3 years, what the market has really wanted was bespoke end market exposure that is relatively narrowly defined. So you've actually seen the large and mid-cap industrial companies breaking apart. And in your portfolio, we've owned Fortive, which was actually a spin-out from Danaher, which itself is now breaking into two different businesses. We haven't waited for all the portfolio managers to do that. What we've done is introduced into the mid-cap industrials companies that have a more bespoke, narrower product focus that maybe applies to different industries. But think about like the HVAC market. Data center cooling technology is all the rage right now because data center construction is all the rage. We don't want to go out and buy the construction company that's building data centers because those contracts can come and go just as quickly. But the companies that are selling the HVAC equipment into that market, which also sell HVAC to residential, to commercial office, to many different end markets, right now they're really benefiting from having some exposure there. And an HVAC system tends to have a lot of aftermarket parts, annual repair and replace service contracts. So we've introduced some HVAC, like purely HVAC exposure into the strategy. Same thing on electronic componentry, water. So there's, you want, and we've introduced a lot more bespoke or narrowly focused industrials into the portfolio. They tend to still have broad end market exposure, but it has become the largest part of the, both our small and mid-cap strategy. So the amount of capital there is the largest of any other sector. So, and it's been our best performing.
Xylem, for example, be of one question.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
The chairman's not here to keep us on track. Hey, what time did we get started?
We started a little late.
Just left at 10 o'clock.
Yeah.
We need favors by keeping you scheduled. We can.
Yeah. Oh, just sometimes I don't want to go.
Well, I think we have a
page. Yeah, we stopped.
Yeah. Do you want to get to page 35?
Yeah.
I want to have you kind of take us through this and what this means. Seems like this is my understanding. It's, this is how you choose who to not invest in. Is that kind of the way?
What this page is. Yeah, it's basically just trying to tell you why do you remove certain companies from it. We are extremely transparent. So every time we delete a position in our quarterly commentary, Harry will tell you we sold it for valuation reasons. It was acquired, so it just left the portfolio the same company bought it. Or there were fundamental challenges that changed our thesis, and it was either a fundamental sale or an outright mistake. Should not have bought that stock or portfolio. So judging based on the percentage of the portfolio that falls in each bucket, we will just tell you every year how much of the portfolio was deleted for those different reasons. You've seen a general decline in the what you basically call deletion turnover. We think that's one of the lessons learned of 2021. Like, portfolio turnover is actually a good thing. And we probably were holding things for too long that in hindsight, we should have removed for many different reasons, either fundamental or valuation. So we don't look at the recent uptick in this as necessarily a worrying sign. It's actually somewhat intentional.
Apologies for stepping out. We've got about 10 more minutes if you wanted me to.
Okay.
If that helps you.
Yeah, so why don't we go into the current environment and I can just put some charts to some of the... Okay, so I talked about this recent environment being one where we probably never would outperform. So what you have on this page are just two what we call factors. So I mentioned free cash flow, return on invested capital, but even more simplistically, you can just say companies that are earning money versus companies that are losing money. The yellow line represents how the companies that are earning the most are doing relative to the companies that are losing the most. So through the first 5 months of this year, the companies that were making the most money were doing great. And for us, that's generally a tailwind. And performance in mid-cap was kind of on par with the benchmark. In small cap, we were outperforming considerably. In June, the market took on what we consider to be a very speculative flavor. So the most unprofitable, the most speculative, the most highly leveraged, the smallest companies all started to outperform. And it almost does a disservice because the relative number is, 15%. At the real tails, it's even worse than that. So this environment where the market wants the things that we purposely avoid has been a massive headwind.
It's not just like something marginally not considered. These are companies that were like on the far end of like
far end of
want to stay away from.
Avoid. Yes.
And this goes beyond AI.
There's an AI component to it, but it goes way beyond AI. If you look at our performance, there's no one sector or industry where our underperformance is concentrated. It's across all of them, which almost tells you it's a philosophical difference of opinion in the market, way beyond AI. You've got earths, you've got metals, you've got gold. I mean, look at what gold's doing. It's from our perspective, it's nonsensical that gold would be up 100% in the same year that stocks are up massively and interest rates are falling because of whatever concerns or fiscal deficit. Something is not right in that conversation. We will always err on the side of junk rallying is not a sustainable posture, which is why we're never going to chase it. On the next page, this is another way to look at the rally. And this has been a powerful factor really for decades, but never more so than the last few months. There is a style of investing called momentum where you just buy the stocks that have done the best over the prior 9 months. And so again, if you measure that, the performance of that in just the last 12 months, just buying the stocks that are up the most, you've outperformed 25, almost 30%. So again, you almost have to have a complete lack of discipline around valuation to benefit from this outcome. And this has been the most powerful driving force of the last 12 months. And the yellow line is the last 3 years. So we have never seen momentum perform the way it has in the last 3 years. And again, if you have a valuation discipline, you are almost always going to underperform in this environment because you're selling that which is working, and you're actually purposefully buying some of the stuff that's been left behind and we think represents great value. And then finally, you probably got large cap managers or exposure. This has been a phenomenon in large cap for a long time. But what this chart is showing is just how concentrated the performance has been in mid cap, which is a new phenomenon. So the green line is just how much the 10 best performing stocks have contributed to the total benchmark's return. There have been moments before where the 10 best stocks added 4 percentage points to the benchmark return. But in those environments, the ones that are circled there, the benchmark itself was up 60-70%. So as a percent of the return, it was very small. In this environment, those 10 stocks, a lot of them AI related, crypto related, Robinhood, the stock trading app, have added more than any 10 stocks have ever contributed to the performance. And yet the benchmark itself is only up 11%. So about 50% of the performance and a good chunk of our underperformance is just the fact that we did not own these 10 stocks. And we've looked at them all. We actually owned Palantir for a brief period in 2023, got out of it thinking it was really expensive then, and it's gone up 500% since we got out. So it's you woulda, coulda, shoulda held on for longer, but our valuation discipline did not allow us to. And so we look at this and we wonder, is this sustainable? Could we have somehow owned those stocks and we're just not Monday morning quarterbacking it? Because the reality is no for a lot of them.
I commend to all of you a book that came out last week called 1929 by Andrew Sorkin. For the New York Times.
Yeah.
And this story is that story.
Yeah.
A few months before the crash.
Yeah, I do.
But I'm not telling you what's going to happen. But I'm telling you, I'm sitting here and I'm thinking, I read this story 2 nights ago. I mean, it's truly, stocks, RCA shooting up out of the sky.
Yeah.
Just crazy. Into the sky, I guess.
Yeah, a lot of it was actually predicted years ago because of the rise of PASC. So, I mean, John Bogle, the like godfather of passive investing, said if the whole market were to ever become passive, it would be ruinous. It would be chaos because there'd be no price discovery. Basically, companies and stocks would be going up just because people were buying them, which is not in and of itself a reason for a stock price to go up. It's a positive feedback loop. We've now crossed, I don't know, 60% in terms of passive ownership of the stock market. So every dollar that goes into the stock market has literally no price discipline. It's just buying things proportional to their weight. There's some research out there from Michael Green, which shows that the further you go into that ownership spectrum, the faster the reset will be. And so to your point about 1929, it's terrifying because right now you've got a one-way train of demand. And if those people ever paused 401k contributions or decided to actually go to cash, it would potentially be a long fall before you found people like us who've done the fundamental analysis and are willing to kind of pay reasonable prices for some of those businesses. So that's another, in addition to Mr. Sorkin's 1929, I think some of Michael Green's research, which he published in 2017, basically predicted that as we moved along this passive ownership continuum, concentration would go up, correlations would go up, valuations would go up, and at some point, again, it's possible to know exactly when, all those things would undo themselves violently.
So for this Russell mid-cap, you're choosing from a portfolio of companies.
Right? Yeah.
Have you seen a challenge with the nature of the companies entering and leaving the cap itself? And their congruence with your principles in the sense of, you know, some of these more speculative things, are those taking over the cap in a sense? And that makes it harder for you to have more to choose from?
It makes it harder for us to outperform. So the answer is yes, they're taking up more of the cap space, if you will, the percentage ownership of the benchmark. If we go to just what we think the next page, this turn, I guess, not the next place, 25. I already told you the quality of our portfolio is the best it's ever been. So the short answer is no, we're not seeing a problem or a lack of quality or, if you will, in what we're buying for.
Yeah.
It's so out of favor right now that it's trading at for discounts that we've, in some instances, never really seen. And so what this chart is showing you is the weighted average discount to fair value for the whole strategy. And it's close to 25%, which you can just kind of look back through time. It's rare that our portfolio trades for 25% less than what we think it's worth, or like what we think if Mr. Buffett were to come along and pay fair value for every one of our holdings, we think we'd make 25% on that day. So,
sorry, could you explain that a little bit more?
Yeah, so Warren Buffett's a big believer that every company has a fair value, what the business is worth based on future fundamental cash flows and dividends.
If somebody as smart as he was going to buy the business, that's what they would pay for.
Right, he buys businesses, right? So if he were going to show up and say, I'm going to buy every company in your portfolio and I'm going to pay fair value, what this chart tells you is that you would all have 25% more money because we'd liquidate, we'd sell everything, and our estimation of fair value would be 25% higher. That's hypothetical, right? He has bought companies in our portfolio over time. And generally, he pays what we think fair value is because he uses the same methods that we use. But back to your question, the nature of the speculation, the narrowness of the performance has made it harder to outperform. I think that's kind of been one of my messages. We think it's generally been great for you all because it's allowed us to increase the quality of the portfolio at relatively inexpensive prices, because nobody's cared about quality in the last 30 years. So if we're going to be relevant, quality is going to come back, and we're going to have a portfolio that is just full of great companies.
So because the demand has shifted to the speculation, you've seen opportunities to enhance the quality.
Yeah, so we've added more positions in the portfolio, right? So it's given us the opportunity to get more shots on goal, great companies at discounted prices. But we're not sitting here saying, oh, lacking for opportunities. We
have actually a portfolio has a lot of great companies, a lot of great exposures to interesting themes. In the last 6 months in particular, it just hasn't happened.
I know you expect market to return to some extent to policy. He will. even if you don't know when, would you ever consider expanding the sectors that you invest in?
We're not exclusionary for the sake of being exclusionary. So we recently bought our first ever hotel company, Wyndham. It wasn't because we just all of a sudden felt like we needed to get exposure to hotels. The hotel business model has fundamentally changed over the last 20 years, where it used to be Marriott, Hilton, Wyndham. You had to go build a hotel. You had to operate that hotel. So it was capital heavy, fickle, because their profits were cyclical because travel demand is relatively cyclical. What's happened is, like restaurants, the great brands have franchised their brands. So they own the brand, but they allow other people to build, own, and operate the locations, and then they take a flat fee. That creates a highly profitable, much less cyclical business for Wyndham, is the one we produced, largest franchise hotel operator in the world. What used to be an outright exclusion for us, because it required leverage and capital and low margin, the business has actually changed to the point where now it looks like high margin, low leverage, buy back stock, pay dividends. And so what was historically an exclusion, we now actually have what we think is an awesome opportunity to expose clients' capital to. So we would happily change our minds on any industry or any exclusion if the business changed in a way that we thought fundamentally made it a better business than currently.
It's interesting you turn to hotels, even what we're looking at retail. So tell me what you took into account or didn't take into account when it comes to travel that led you to buy it.
So Wyndham owns primarily economy and kind of mid-market brands. So the thing about any kind of cycle is you might get shrinking of the overall pie, but you get a lot of trade down as well. So where they operate, it's more of a blue collar kind of business traveler tier, and has proven the other benefit is you've got 15 years, 20 years of data now where you can go back and look at the performance through different cycles. It's proven to be much less cyclical than particularly leisure travel or personal travel exposed brands or luxury. So there's an appreciation for where they sit in the ecosystem. There's an appreciation that travel has become an ever-increasing part of people's budgets. So it actually is less cyclical than it used to be, in part because of work from home, just changing preferences. So all of those things together kind of, and then the fact that it's generates 35% EBITDA margins, buys back stock, pays a dividend. The hotels of today just look a lot different than the hotels of the last true consumer recession, which was 2008, 2009. Now, the concern about the travel environment is what gave us the opportunity to get stuck. Because when everything is going well and the economy is humming and people are traveling, travel budgets are going up, the stocks can get overpriced. And we did the work on Wyndham a while ago, but we didn't have a discount. As concerns about the consumer frugality or the consumer environment have crept into the stock, it's given us that discount and given us the opportunity to introduce it. So who knows if we'll be right? I mean, we have to still see the thesis play out, but that's kind of the thinking around why we would now own a hotel versus historically pretty much never even considered.
What's your short item? Yeah. Let's call it. Any closing comments?
No, I'm appreciative that the relative performance has not stacked up, and we appreciate your long-term support of us, and I think you have some of the benefit of seeing some of the really good years from Champlain. I know not all of you have been on board maybe long enough to have lived through those periods, but relative to what we've endeavor to create for clients in terms of the composition of our portfolio, we actually feel really good. So we're competitive people who want to outperform, but we're also not willing to sacrifice our philosophy or our process in order to try to outperform in this particular environment. So, you know, we're going to do our best, and when it comes back in favor, we expect to deliver for you all again.
Thank you. Appreciate your time. Appreciate your coming. Let's take 5 minutes again.
Thank you.
Thanks for checking in so much.
Well, you're never as smart as people are.
I have a big fan in my bedroom, and I just texted my husband, you have a bed, turn the fan, I don't make up calls. Well, it's actually a swamp cooler. When I just
We're back.
Thank you. Cigna is giving away a little loss.
We could also do the validation presentation, which is kind of a little slide.
Well, it reminds me of when I worked at a hospital in the early 2000s, the drugs, You don't have to buy many school supplies, that's for sure. Since 2005.
You have to pay for students.
Yeah.
I've heard that.
I'm ready for something new. My retirement is only in 2030, so.
Let's get started next 3 minutes.
It's funny sometimes, though. Every once in a while, you have to face the point, not the fear. It's like someone you've met and like 10 times and you have been in person. Like, I have this lady come up to me. I'm not really sure.
Public safety healthcare is not the
biggest.
Yes, I should have more comprehensive because of that growth value dynamic. And I wanted them to be able to get into a little bit more detail that then they maybe did. Well, in Champlain, I mean, when you're looking at the class, like, they're behind. It's 100%. They're really bad. It's not necessarily for seeing the cap space, but when you're evaluating, which is really difficult. So I thought it was important for them to come in and for you to hear what they had to say. And they are very clear on challenges. And it came out much more clearly.
My client, she had PTSD after the Gabriel Bryan for about 12,
Is everybody here? All right, let's get started. Lunch is coming, but Dana's got a hard stop at really needs to leave here in about a half an hour. So let's do your 9 slides. Maybe then we'll take a quick break and grab us a lunch and we can have the rest of the discussion.
Very good.
Okay?
Sounds good.
All right, so let's go.
All right. Well, thank you for having me today. So it's going to be short and sweet. It was a pretty nice, uneventful year, at least in terms of the TSRS pension plan. So I can't speak to the outside world, but your year was a great year. Things are similar to where we expected to be. As of this year, just a little bit better than we expected. And as an actuary, if I could choose where my results would be every single year, it would be exactly there, right? It would be just a little bit better than expected, because you never want to err on the wrong side and come out behind. But you also don't want to have some big leap ahead where all of a sudden, you know, problem is solved, unfunded liability is gone, and we're wondering what sort of volatility is going to shake out after that, right? So something that's sort of along the route where we expected, but just a little bit better, is perfect. So what is causing this year's good results? And the main lever is going to be investment results every year, causing our main ups and downs, right? That's going to be our biggest source of volatility. This year, nothing too extreme, but a very nice return. In terms of how we measure things, that was a 12.5% return, well above our 6.75% assumption. Once we do our 5-year smoothing, you remember we do that 5-year smoothing that takes some of the volatility out of the market value that we pull on that valuation date. We end up at a 7.9% return, basically for our decision making results. So again, that's going to be a nice gain for the plan, but nothing too extreme. We did have some salary losses on the liabilities, which on the surface doesn't sound so good. It does hurt your funded ratio a little bit because it drives up the liabilities. But when we look forward, we're going to turn around and get more contributions on those increased salaries. So it doesn't really end up affecting your outlook all that much. The next three are just pure positives for the plan. So active counts are up. So that means we got some extra new hires. We didn't just replace the people that retired or quit. We actually got some new ones. And so those people, they come in with $0 liabilities, $0 in assets, but they're getting 30-some percent of pay contributions into the plan, and that's going to help us pay off that unfunded liability. That's going to spread that third over a bigger base. Admin expenses were down pretty notably this year. Ultimately, we're not sure if maybe that's a little bit of a short-term temporary thing that those are down so much. We're not sure where they'll end up settling. But anytime expenses are down, that's a good thing, whether it's temporary or not. And then, of course, we have those strong contributions coming in. Those are already part of our expectation that we build into the model. So when I talk about things being better than expected, this particular piece isn't part of that. This isn't better than expected. It's just that we do expect improvement in our funded ratio and our unfunded liability because of those contributions. We expect the funded ratio to go up every year and the unfunded liability to go down.
I should mention briefly or ask, because we do have at least two plan participants, if you will. Our administrative expenses are what percentage of our assets?
You know,
it's minuscule.
Assets, because we measure them as a percentage of pay, and so I think it's like 0.37% of pay. So
I think our it's
like 600.
600,000 thereabouts on $800 million of total assets. So we're not living large. Yeah. Okay.
That's why the retreat is here.
But do feel free to join us for lunch. Yes.
Let's see.
All right, keep going.
Okay. So in terms of our static results, those are going to be things like your funded ratio, your unfunded liability. Those are going to be metrics where we basically just stop things in time as of June 30, 2025. So on those metrics, we had good progress. Your unfunded liability is down. Funded ratio is up. Again, much of that expected. But the part that was not expected was favorable. So we had liability losses of $3 million, but we had asset gains of $11 million. So it more than offset that. You had a $1 million gain. On forward-looking results, where we take into account the ongoing payroll going forward, things like how long it takes us to get to full funding, we also had improvement on those metrics. So last year, depending on whether it was net gain from market value or the smooth value, we expected to get to full funding in either 2034 or 2035. This year, we had that good return. Both asset numbers improved, but market was able to do a little bit of catch up to the smooth value. And so they both came out at 2033 this year, so 8 years. So in terms of employee contribution rates, the city had another year of not adopting the recommended rates. They have done that many times in the past. The rates that the variable groups are paying right now during the current fiscal year are 7.25% and 5.75%. Based on the board's funding policy, we should be 7.756. That's that one-half normal cost policy. They basically pay one-half their benefit accruals. But we are not too worried about that. As long as the city continues to put in their 27.5, we are not encouraging you to chase down that extra half or quarter percent from those employees. It does not even change the year of full something. Either way, we're still at 2033, even with those lower employee rates. All right. So these are your snapshot results. Basically, unfunded liabilities are down and funded ratios are up. More than half of that was expected progress coming from the contributions coming in. We expect stay down the unfunded. We expect the funded ratio to improve. So at 2025, on our sort of smooth decision-making numbers, we have a $272 million debt, our unfunded liability, that needs to be paid off, and our assets cover about 79% of our current obligations. The market value numbers are even better, and so what that will do is put positive pressure on those decision-making numbers next year. All right, so here we're looking at the development of the actuarial contribution rate. The actuarial contribution is made up of three components, the normal cost, the amortization of our unfunded liability, and the admin expenses. So as a reminder, normal cost is how much we think we need to cover the cost of this year's service accruals. So, you know, as an active member goes from 10 to 11 years of service, how much does that cost? And the blended rate on that is 12.65%. We do expect that number to slowly trend down as we replace Tier 1 employees with Tier 2 that cost a bit less. So we have that normal cost, 12.65, and then we have this piece to pay off sort of your legacy debt, basically our mortgage. And that piece is down substantially because we got extra new hire payroll to spread it. So that's 11.57%. Then we've got our ongoing admin costs, again, also down. And so a total of 24.56%. And just a reminder, that is total. That's not the city's portion. So if we subtract out the blended employee rate, it's going to be the city's minimum contribution rate is 18.68%. And so that's basically what they have to contribute by city code. It's that bottom there. So hold on to these numbers in your brain. At the bottom of the page, it says actuarial rate. So 19.97 last year, 18.68 this year, and we're going to reconcile to the next page. All right, so we were at that 19.97. The funding policy, basically putting in 27.5 instead of that 19.97, that's going to pay off that unfunded liability faster, and it's going to drive that rate down. And so it drove it down 0.73%. So if market value had earned 6.75 and we got those 27.5% contributions, which we did, we would have expected an actuarial rate of 19.24. But we had all this good experience this year. We had good investment returns, we had admin expenses be down, and then we got those extra new hires, that additional contributory payroll to spread that burden. And so we ended up down at 18.68%. So a good outcome.
The extra contributory payroll, that's a number that factors in or the fact that those extra employee payroll, that those extra employees will be beneficiaries in the future, that gets factored in as well, right?
Yeah, I mean, okay. We definitely start accruing a normal cost for them and right. That kind of thing. But, I mean, if you think about it, their normal cost is maybe 12% of pay, and we're getting 30%.
I understand. And that will change over time as they vest and stay long.
Yeah, I mean, the people that stayed until retirement do end up costing more than their normal right. cost. And so it's kind of
yeah.
a flow and an average.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, that's a long time.
But I think, to your point, as the city contributes less in the future, the benefit of those extra people can decrease a little bit compared to right now, since the city's contributing so much.
Right, but I mean, it would take a lot of reduction for those new hires not to help. I mean,
yeah.
When we're talking, well, for that normal, theoretically, we're getting,
yeah.
you know, 33.5%.
Yeah.
Okay, so here we are.
Sorry, what is the definition of it? Extra payroll or extra contribution payroll? What is that?
So it's just like if you look at the valuation report, you'll see, you know, an active count. And I off top of my head, if you maybe at like 2,800, am I making that up? Well, anyway, let's just say you were at 2,800 last year. You're at 2,900 this year. And so that extra 100 employees that the city filled positions for this year, as of June 30, 2025, that's 100 extra people that we are getting contributions on. And yes, they are accruing benefits under the plan, and so that's an extra cost for the plan. But the money that's coming in for those people so far exceeds the cost of their benefits that it really helps pay off that unfunded liability and make that rate that we need lower. Okay, so here we are looking at the employee contributions by group. If you got hired before July 1, 2006, you got Tier 1 benefits, so that's that 2.25% multiplier, and your employee contribution got locked in at 5%. So you got higher benefits, low frozen contributions. If you got hired in the second group between 2006 and 2011, you still got the higher Tier 1 benefits, but you had to pay more for it. So based on the current policy, you have to pay one half of your group's normal cost, which is 7.6%. So that second number down there. And then you round up to the nearest quarter percent, which is 7.75%. So it's the same number as was recommended last year for its funding policy. But as I mentioned, the city decided to leave it at 7.25% of this year. So there's still that half percent disconnect. You got hired in the last group. You get Tier 2 benefits, you get the 2% multiplier, and you also had to pay one half normal cost, but this group has lower benefits, so they have lower normal costs. That's coming out at 5.99%, so rounds up to 6%. Again, the city left it at 5.75%, so there's a 40% disconnect. And so part of today's segment here, the board does need to approve the recommended member rates. And so the recommended rates based on your funding policy would be these here at 7.75.
So. Should we do that right now or should we do it at the end of your presentation? Let's do it right now. Okay. Do I hear a motion to approve the FY27 recommended rates based on the TSRS funding policy?
I have a motion.
Thank you. Is there a second?
Second.
Yeah, okay.
Question.
Any discussion?
Are we approving the just recommended rates for the employees?
Right.
Yes. We're approving the FY2026 adopted rates.
Okay.
Yes, for 2027. Okay. Any discussion? Call the vote.
Shell?
Yes.
Terry?
Yes.
Oh. Dave?
Aye.
Charlton?
Aye.
Kimberly?
Aye.
John?
Aye.
And Mark?
Aye. Thank you. Proceed.
Okay. So slide 9 is a projection of unfunded liability getting paid off, funded ratio coming up to 100%. So this is sort of the if everything goes as expected. You know, we earn 6.75% each and every year. Demographic assumptions play out like we expect. And so if it goes as expected, we again expect that unfunded liability to be paid off in 2033. And reach 100% funded ratio. You know, we know in reality there is volatility. There's a cone of outcomes around this scenario. We aren't going to earn 6.75% each and every year. Not going to have demographic assumptions work out perfectly. But it's still absolutely good news that the expectation is only 8 years out. In a few minutes, we are going to be talking about potentially implementing the glide path funding approach, where we reduce the city's contribution by 1% of paid each year if the results tell us it's okay to do so. And so if we were to look at this same trajectory under that approach with the potentially slightly lower city contributions, the year of full funding would be 2034. So it's nothing extreme. It's not like completely delaying full funding. It's just 1 year. And then it does have the trade-off continuing to get some additional city contributions after June funding. So a little bit less now, a little bit more later. The investment people made it look so easy. And so as things continue to go well, as we get closer to full funding, we need to decide what sort of policies we do want to have in place to approach that full funding. And I would encourage you to be proactive, not reactive. Don't wait until you get to full funding to make changes to the policy. And so the questions to you today are, do you want to make changes? If you do want to make changes, how soon do you want to make them? Do you want to try and get a change in for fiscal year 2027 for that contribution, which is basically the decision that is made today? You know, you just made that member contribution vote. We also have to make a city recommendation. And so coming out of today, do you want to have that still be the 27.5, or would you consider going to the 26.5 as part of this new policy? So it's something to think on if we get into such a discussion.
Are we having a discussion now?
Not quite yet. We've got like one more slide, and then maybe you guys are getting food, and then we're having a discussion.
Do you want to eat or not?
Oh, I don't need to eat. I'll get there.
Okay. So what I'm anxious about, this is a big decision. We had the discussion last month. We were going to vote today. Our expert is in a time crunch. I'm anxious. I want to have the discussion. If it's clear that there's a consensus, I have no problem having a vote. If there's any sense that this thing is a little up and down, I'd rather have discussion until Dana has to leave, and then we can vote next month. Because, again, this is not something that has to be decided today. And it's not that I'm trying to avoid the discussion, but I don't want to end up with a decision that is rushed.
And I think that if the decision, the recommendation is made in November, I think that's still fine for budget purposes for the city.
Yes.
Okay.
So I think that
all works. Right. So let's, unless anybody's stomach is really rumbling, let's let Dana continue and leave the food for a few minutes.
And I just realized I have like embarrassingly few comments on the slide. It's, okay. You know, whatever the board decides about funding policy in terms of evaluation results, it was a good year. We're on a good course. And it's great that these are the kinds of decisions that we have to be making in our looking at this funding policy and potentially reducing contribution. So you're in a great position.
Good. All right. So onward to that discussion. Yes.
I can open on it.
Everybody, please speak up.
Yeah, I've been giving a lot of thought to this topic for the last month. And I've been trying to think of how can we find a good win-win with the city. One, to appreciate the extra contributions that they've made. But two, to be sensitive to the situation that they're in. I understand that we'll learn more today about the fiduciary responsibility that we have to the pension more than we have to, you know, the city day-to-day, right? That said, this idea that the administrative or the staffing levels are such a good benefit to us, actuarially speaking, I wonder if we can do some kind of win-win where we reduce the percentage that the city contributes if they reach certain staffing targets or something like that, because that it's hard for the city to justify spending the staff, but if that reduction actually benefits both of us sufficiently, I wonder if there might be some space there that we could explore, because then it would give the city a little bit more certainty direction to do that. It would benefit us from having more tier two contributors. I just don't know from order of magnitude how well that goes. The more that we reduce, the more the city reduces the rate, the less beneficial that staff is too. So there'd be
that may overcomplicate it, and maybe it's more of a framing. Maybe we adopt the glide path policy and we say, you know, with this relief that you're getting, we strongly recommend that you look at putting towards increasing staffing, because that will help ensure that you get further relief from your contributions in the future, because as one said, it'll be a coming foundation. So I just wanted to start.
I don't see the city trying to increase that. We're in a frost right now, so I don't see the city increasing staffing. However, if I may say this at this table, a reduction in the rate would be favorable to the city given the financial constraints that we have staffing with.
So the financial cost of increasing staff would be far more than the benefit.
Yes, you're right.
And I think, Mr. Chair, if I could, also I think it's important when you have this deliberation that the board recognize its role. And so if the board were to make a recommendation that ventures into staffing, that's outside the board's scope.
Yeah.
So I think that would be the complication there. I think the board's ultimate obligation is to make sure that the 18.68% is funded by the city. Everything above and beyond that from the city is helpful, and we are in, if you will, bonus territory in terms of making the system whole. So I think that we want to continue to encourage the city to go above and beyond, and we want to let the city figure out how to do that. So if the city continues to staff above Dana's assumptions, that's also a help. But I think that's outside of the board's parameters to recommend.
Well, and I guess it occurs to me that beyond the parameters, and that's particularly challenging because you're talking about elected officials who have a plate full of considerations that are way beyond. But specifically to suggest to the council that you should be hiring more people because that will help the pension plan is, it ignores, it's terrible optics. You all hired 10 more people at this. You can just hear the person who's running against the city council. You voted to hire more people so that you would have more money in the pension plan to pay existing employees. It's not that it wouldn't be helpful, but you gotta go a couple of steps out. And I think, and I know this predated me, but there was a pretty significant controversy that John will remember when we had an issue about counsel for the board and counsel for the city. And I don't remember the details or the nuances, and they're not important for today. But butting up against the city manager, the city attorney's office, and the city council is not generally helpful for us. They've been generous. We should not ignore the fact that that generosity serves the city's interests as well. Having a city that is not faced with an underfunded pension plan is a really good thing. Look at Detroit, look at Orange County when they had their fiasco. So it serves the city's interests, but it also serves our interests. We want to remember that your place. I'll leave it at that. So, what other discussion?
If I might make a comment, I had put my hand up, but I know it's hard to track.
I apologize. I'm focused on. I can only do so many things at my age. Keep going. Sorry.
I just had entered into the chat box. I support Angel's comments, and I added, it is not practical as an expectation at this time that we would count on significantly expanding workforce numbers. Just as we are looking forward and we're examining budget capacity and plans for workforce overall, we're measuring every single position that is vacated. And we are measuring distinctly whether or not it will be posted as a vacancy.
I think I'd add to that, we should all bear in mind that if you look at consumer sentiment indexes and everything else, the suggestions that are out there are that it's more likely that we're going to be worrying about hard times than better times. And I think, you know, we've all been blessed for several years on this. Well, most of you have been on this board for a long time. This board and the Tucson Sunbelt Maritime System have been blessed by a whole lot of good years. And when the years haven't been great, we've managed to recover quickly. It's a lot to be worried about. And I think we should keep that in mind. But let me ask you this, Dana. Did you have your hand up?
No, I didn't, but I did have a comment.
Okay. If we adopt a plan now, we can revise that plan next year, correct?
Right. And I mean, the plan itself is adaptable. Like it responds to experience, right?
It does.
Because we have that 6% right. buffer. And so, you know, right now the rate is 18.68%, right? And say we have some extreme market event and next year it is 24%. That would be pretty extreme, right? Like to
20.
Well, we can talk about a couple different examples, right? So let's say next year it is 24%. And say we did adopt this and made a recommendation to the city to do 26.5. The policy would say stay at 26.5 again the next year because you don't have your buffer anymore. You only have 2.5%. And so don't let it go down any further. Well, let's say instead we have an extreme, extreme market event and it goes up to 29%. Well, this policy would still say you have to put in the minimum,
right,
which is 29%.
Right.
So, you know, if the plan is in hard times, it's still going to demand money from the city. It's just if we're riding along well above our actuarial requirements, then we could get some relief.
And if we're at 29% and our plan says stay at 26.5 and the city says we're laying off 10% of our employees and, you know, we're going to make the statutory minimum and that's it, that's all, we're going to have to figure out a little with that too.
Well, and I mean, you know, yeah. I think what we're talking here is if it was such an extreme market event that the actuarial rate is actually 29%, and then by the statutory or the city code, they would have to put in the 29. But, you know, I'd have to go back and actually figure out what kind of event it would need to be to cause something like that. But I don't.
I think I said at the last meeting, we should all remember that what organizations and entities are obligated to do is not always what they can do. And when you get into the realm where you can't, we have to deal with that situation too.
Well, and also, so, you know, in terms of that extreme event, where we go up to the 29, there's no change in reaction of the funding policy between what you have in place now versus what's being proposed today. They would both say 29%. This is only if times are good. So.
Okay. Kimberly?
Just a couple of comments. First one is, how long has it been 27.5%? Or, like, when did we... Like, when we talk about how 18.68, it wasn't... If I took some notes here, that's the ordinance. And we're at the 27.5. You know, we're talking about that. That's almost a 10-point swing, you know, it gives the appearance that, you know, city's paying so much more, right, than what it has to. But we're at 80% funding. You know, so as a fiduciary, I've been thinking about this a lot, too, since the last meeting. And as a fiduciary, like, our responsibility, I mean, we care about the city. I mean, obviously, we care about the city. We want the city to be successful. We want them to be in their budget. But, I mean, we could be, you know, the city has some financial issues, you know, and staffing may be being looked at. So I guess, you know, and you said that if we did this, it would only change the trajectory path, you know, by a year. We'd be going from 2033 to 2034. You know, that seems kind of surprising, you know, to have such a big decision, but it's only going to change a year, you know, of the glide path. So I just wanted to make some comments on this. Also, like, our city, where are we in relation to other cities as far as funded liability? I mean, are we, you know, at the high end? Are we at the low end? You know, what's the city of Phoenix? I should have investigated this, you know, before the debate. But, I mean, surely the city wants us to be, you know, have a good, you know, funded plan. And I know we just have to do everything in our power, you know, to keep it that way. And I read, you know, when I became a board member, like one of the goals of the board was to be well defunded, you know, so that's one of our like goals for, on our, on this board. And so when I look at that, you know, with the passion for the fiduciary responsibility, with the passion of it's only going to change the trajectory for a year, you know, do we do this or do we just continue to ride it? Now, we could continue to go as is, but then the city will say, well, the city could say, well, we're only obligated to be 18.68%. You know, that's our ordinance, right? And then what would, then, you know, what would the conversation back and forth, which surely the city doesn't want the plan to go from 80% funded to 70% funded to 60%, you know, I mean, it could get worse. So I'm just, based on the analysis that you do with all of this, and I've read all your reports, it's really well done. Like, where are we, you know, in conjunction with other cities? Like,
well, I'd say in terms of your trajectory, you're one of my better plans. Like, Tucson, as it is, does not keep me up at night. But you are 80% funded, right? You're not 90% funded. You're not 100% funded. You still have a ways to go. You still have to keep that commitment up. And so, like, my lack of concern is based on the assumption that you keep the commitment. If we do get into a world where, you know, we're trying to contribute the least amount possible and we're haggling the board over what contribution rates are, then I would have extreme concerns for you. It's always about the ongoing basis, right? Where are we going? Not where are we now? So, you know, 80% funded can take a lot of directions, right? It's not, you're accruing new benefits all the time. It's always about the ongoing commitment. Let me try to address a couple of your other things that you said. So, I mean, I think it's an ongoing discussion with the city. And I think, you know, you mentioned it's only a year difference. So I think it's not a big difference from like a fiduciary perspective to have that 1% reduction. You know, if we're getting 33.5 between member city and instead we're getting 32.5, it's still a big contribution to funded liability. It's still very sustainable. I still feel very good about that trajectory. But in terms of the city's mindset, I think the idea that there might be some relief coming could be a big lever in their decision to make the bigger contribution or the 18.68. If the board is here offering, well, this year, let's do 26.5, and if things go well, 25.5 the next year, I feel like, you know, as they're making these difficult decisions, they might feel better about that higher rate. And that has always been part of this slide path discussion is, you know, the conversation with the city. And it's in terms of the plan, it's not a one-sided change to the funding policy, right? It's less now than later. It's, you know,
less over the next 7 or 8 years, and then more in 7 or 8 years when we get to full funding, so that we can absorb some diversity if we have to. And I think it's a win-win for everyone, because with those additional contributions later, it's better for the plan, obviously, with the additional contributions to be able to absorb some adverse experience, but it also means better contribution stability for city in those out years. So anyway, I'm not sure if I got to all the pieces.
So this isn't necessarily my view, but to throw the other end hypothetical, are we giving the city enough relief? Like, is there a chance where we're staying too high more than what the city can kind of maintain, that will have kind of a domino effect on staffing and other things, which could impact us worse in the long term? Does that make sense? Especially if, like, let's say something bad happens and we stay locked in. I'm not necessarily saying that we should lower it or just tell them to take it. But could that result in a situation where it would be, like it would have been better for us to give a little bit more relief sooner, so that there could be a little more stability on their side as we're playing down? I just wanted to throw that view out and see what people thought.
Yeah, I see that point. One of the things I do like about this slide is giving the council some recognition of their excess contributions and seeing maybe the light and being proactive to avoid a more severe reaction if there is some downturn.
Yeah.
So that is one to be given
for me. And if I could, just from the historical perspective, when the 27.5% was set, I think that gave us a buffer of 2 or 3%. It was not a big extra contribution as a percentage of pay.
At that time, the
statutory rate was much higher. Yeah. And so the board was happy to get 1% extra, 2% extra. Every dollar mattered at that time. So if you think about how much that gap has increased to now, we're at almost a 10% buffer. That, I think, does speak to the city's commitment to voluntarily do this for 10 years, and it has paid off. I like Dana's plan because it doesn't necessarily drop off all of the board's protection either, right? So it is gradual, and I think the policy behind these funding recommendations has always been to maintain a cooperative relationship with the city. And I think that the implementing the glide path, whether it's this year or next year, that's what it speaks to. It's recognizing that the city is going above and beyond. And it's saying that you don't have to continue at this level until we fall off the cliff, as Dan explained. And I think to the point of, you know, could it potentially cost staffing, right? If the city is in a crisis situation. And at that point, I think the city would only be looking at their 18.68%, right? If they are at the decision between TSR's contributions and layoffs, 27.5% went off the table previously, right? So I think that they've been realistic about knowing that there are extra contributions built in here. And we never, as a fiduciary body, want to protect the system, but we never want to cost people their jobs, right? Because a pension is secondary to the job itself, right? And I think the board has always been mindful of those things. So to me, the question for you all to consider is, personally, I think the glide path makes sense. It's a question of when, right? And I think, you know, that was Dana's slide. Is it time to make a funding policy change and incorporate that recommendation into 27? Or do you want to see, for example, do you want to see that funding number at a square 80%? You know, we've been moving towards 80% and hoping to get to 80% for a long time. We are very close, but
It is not quite there yet. So you could, you know, if it doesn't feel like the right time now, maybe you set a parameter on this is when we will do funding policy. That's just a suggestion.
I do like the idea, though, of being able to tell the city soon that we have taken a step in their direction, because their decision will be made months from now. And between now and then, we don't know what will happen, but it can only benefit us if we've taken a step in their direction, particularly when we've done it before it's apparent that it needed to be done. You know, it's person who's willing to give somebody else a break when they really need it is great. The person who's willing to give them a break before they know they really need it is even better. It's just a good tactic in negotiations to get out. So I don't know, Dana. You gotta get. Do we want to have a vote, or do you all want to think a little more? We can do it in November. We are going to have a meeting in November. But are we?
Yes.
We'll have to deal with the date because Thanksgiving is the fourth Thursday. So
okay.
Not going to do it on Thanksgiving Day.
We can have it all virtual if you like.
Yeah, well, but we're still going to have to find a different date.
Right, yes.
Yeah. So what's the pleasure? Do you all want to vote today or?
Really fast, sorry. It's already scheduled for Thursday the 20th.
Oh, it's already scheduled?
Yeah. That's okay. The same week as Thanksgiving.
No,
sorry.
Thanksgiving's the 27th.
It's already moved to April break.
Sorry. So,
I don't know.
What's pleasure?
You know, I'd be comfortable.
Okay. Did we ever get a written resolution? I didn't see anything. But remember we talked about?
The
funding policy?
Yeah. Is it in the materials?
It is.
Oh. Yeah.
Yes, there is a red line of the funding policy.
And what? Okay.
A print one out for you today. We just sent it to you.
Can we put it on the screen?
Yes.
We can take a look at that while we eat.
Yeah, wait. You want to take a look at it while we eat?
Yeah, we don't. Yeah. We'll either keep going.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Let me take that thing out. No, I want you to make your flight. You know,
so the one thing I wanted to point out, if you do make a motion and vote today, just decide what the effective date should be, because we did leave that as a question mark. So whatever you think the effective date should
be. What would be the effective date if we wanted to? Would it be January 1 of 2026?
November 1st, 2025.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right.
What do you think?
Yeah, so it would be like adopting this funding policy, and if you made this funding policy effective, say, like November 1st or today or whatever, then that would affect the recommendation that the board gives to the city for fiscal year 2027.
Okay.
And the net result, just to be clear before you leave, it would reduce the board's recommendation to 26.5% for the next
month. Exactly.
Okay.
All right. Well, keep me posted.
All right. Safe travels. Thanks for coming.
Yeah.
I think you just had it up, Matt.
Yes.
Yeah. I'll try this. Let's get it up. Isn't that it, right?
Yeah, it's just making me activate.
Can you get out of that?
Oh,
thanks, Dana.
Excuse me.
Is Terry up?
No, Terry left.
Okay.
Funding policy revision.
There should be a PDF of at least of the additional materials.
I have one.
And if they wouldn't have sent out a Word version to the board.
Okay. In Anastasia's email. Hey, hold on, let me go into.
if, by the way, if we get this done, we can take a look in the next couple of weeks and see if we don't have anything that's critical
for
November. We can put off the November.
Where would it have been done?
I have the funding policy up, the PDF version. If you'd like me to share my screen, I'll...
Not that I'm aware of.
Go ahead and share your screen. No, then she can't drive it.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah.
But if you have a PDF,
it's under additional materials.
Back down. TSRS board. Additional materials.
Oh, thanks. Got it.
Second one at the top.
Uh-oh. That's fine. Can I make this like this? Can you drive it like that? Can you see it enough?
Yeah, I can.
I mean, we can make it bigger if you want.
Can we do it a little bit bigger?
There we go.
Or even if you, maybe that one. There we go.
Okay. Would you like to get lunch or do you want me to go through this?
Pardon me?
Would you like to get your lunch or do you want me to go through this first?
Let's get this done.
Yeah. I'm just going to, the funding policy, I think most of you have seen before.
Yeah.
And the goal here has always been to outline the strategy to get to the full funding and incorporate the rounding policy. So the rounding policy has been applied to adjust the member rates, and it's part of the recommendations. And then we've always used it also to recommend the 27.5% for the city. So Dana and I made a couple changes to just update the language. So this change here in terms of this section is the goals of the funding policy. So to extinguish the unfunded liability within a reasonable time frame. As of this date, Dana kept our projected time frame of 2030 to 2035.
Like the spread as opposed to a year. Yeah. Thank you.
And then the second goal is to encourage the city to make additional contributions. And we've struck the language that sets the minimum of 27.5% to get to the glide path that's spelled out later. Okay. The authority here, this talks about the difference between our recommended rates from the board and the code required rates, which Dana has explained. But we wanted to acknowledge that there are differences. We're not recommending what is required from code. And then most of this language is unchanged until we get to Dana's new stabilizing policy. This is member contribution rates. So this is just really updating language. We're not making a change to how the member contribution rates are calculated or rounded. The rounding, as Dana mentioned, has not been adopted by the city recently, but we still recommend it. Now, when we get to the required city contribution rates, that's where you'll see the changes. Here, we just updated the language about how Dana is going about her calculations to clarify that, you know, she showed you that calculation of the 33% where she is looking at what is the full required contribution. She's backing out what do the members contribute, and then she's getting to the city's base contribution obligation, which is the 18.68%. Here, we rewrote this to clarify that the member rates, we have three different member rates, so she does a blend, and that was 5.88% for her current calculations. Now here we talk about the board will review the required city contribution rate. And again, that's our 18.68%.
and then determine the recommended city contribution rate, okay, which has been 27.5% for the last 10 years. We struck all of this language here to put in Dana's new recommendation, which is contribution stability. To determine the recommended city contribution rate for the upcoming fiscal year, the board shall apply a formula intended to provide stability in the city's contributions to TSRS as the funded status of TSRS increases. The board will recommend that the city contribute the greater of the city contribution rate adopted for the current fiscal year and the required city contribution rate. So this goes to Dana's last example where she said, if we have a market failure and the required rate goes to 29, 29 is the rate, okay? But otherwise, we're going to say that the baseline is that you hold steady, okay? Then there's an exception. However, the current city contribution rate, if the current city contribution rate exceeds the required rate by 6%, right now we've got about 10%. So if it exceeds by 6% or more, the board will recommend a reduced city contribution rate equal to the current rate minus 1%. And that's how we get to this 26.5% instead of the current 27.5%. So that preserves the 6% buffer that Dana wants to have every year going forward. So the excess or the bonus contributions would be at least 6%. The contribution stability provision is intended to facilitate consistency in the budgeting of the city's annual contribution obligation and to support the annual liquidity needs of TSRS, because that's the other piece of this, that eventually we're going to need extra cash to pay benefits. The board recognizes and appreciates the city's shared commitment to extinguishing the unfunded liability over a prudent time horizon by contributing more than the required city contribution each year. The board anticipates that the recommended city contribution will continue to exceed the required city contribution by a small measure after TSRS achieves full funding in order to address investment fluctuations and potential benefit modifications. So this is what Dana referenced as, you know, there's two sides to this equation. It's important in her calculations that when we hit that magic 100% funding, she still wants a buffer. She doesn't want to go down to just paying the normal costs and the expenses. So this would basically give the city not advanced knowledge that we're not going to go down to the bare minimum, but we will get there more gradually. And this would give a buffer to absorb market fluctuations and potentially address a COLA if we get to that point. And then I think that's it.
So the one thing I noticed is, can you scroll back up to where you had the 1%?
Yes.
In the formula? It doesn't deal with years after that.
Well, it's an annual formula. So if we go to 26.5% for this upcoming year.
Okay, the current equal to the city, current city. So in 3 years, the current city would be whatever. I got it. Okay.
Mm-hmm. That's right. It's the last adopted rate is what we're calling the current.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah.
She covered that.
Okay.
All right. Do I hear a motion to approve the policy?
So I motion to approve the funding policy effective November 1st.
Okay. Is there a second? I hear somebody say Seth.
Yeah,
Dave.
I'm Joe.
Oh, or on Hal. Okay. All right. Do we have more discussion? Happy to have it.
And Charlotte, that's what you said, November 1st?
Yes.
Do we need to change anything on this revised policy to incorporate the new rates employees?
Well, no, that we don't have to.
Nope.
The option would be to get rid of the rounding on the recommendation that we round those employee rates up. But that has worked well except for the last few years. So I don't know that there's reason to back off of that recommendation. And they cost and do what they want on the city rates or the employee rates.
Okay. Any more discussion? All right. Let's call the vote.
All right. I'm Jill.
Aye.
Terry is absent from the vote.
Okay.
Dave?
Aye.
Charlton?
Aye.
Kimberly?
Aye.
John?
Aye.
And Mark?
Aye. All right. Thank you all. This was a good process. Thank you, Dana.
Yeah, I've never been called an actuary. I just want to also note there is one more document that was distributed to you. It's a one-page document. It's the statement of our actuarial assumptions. I know you can't see this, but it is technically part of your funding policy, and we're required to have these assumptions written down. So, Dana has updated it to include our assumptions as of July 1 of 24. So it's just to keep things current. So by adopting the funding policy, you've adopted this as well.
Okay. And I was remiss, thank you, Cassie, as well for drafting, for what it's worth, drafting this sort of stuff is not necessarily the easiest thing.
It really isn't.
At all. No, it's not.
Okay.
The bane of my existence is a lawyer.
So lunch and then fiduciary drink.
Yes. All right.
Great.
Lunchtime. You all.
The patient feel any better, Cassie. The last time I entered a fiduciary drink, I actually found it really asleep.
Oh, good. Thank you.
I would like at lunch.
I really enjoyed that.
Which